You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Best of Flashpoints for the week of August 17th, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, with the recent court ruling against Monsanto, what are the implications and those who are being wounded every day by the misuse of pesticides? We'll speak with Dr. Ann Lopez about that. Then, is Pope Francis trying to put an end to the global scourge of child rape and molestation that has been perpetrated by the Roman Catholic Church for centuries? Or is he, like his predecessors, trying to cover it up by any means necessary? All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Today we kick off the program with an interview from Tuesday's show as we feature an interview on what are the implications and those who are being wounded every day by the misuse of pesticides after the recent victory against Monsanto.
We are delighted to be joined now by Dr. Ann Lopez. She's the director of the Center for Farmworker Families based in Felton, California. Dr. Lopez is an emerita professor and has taught courses in biology, environmental science, ecology. She has been fighting Monsanto and other chemical corporations for decades. A little bit more, Dr. Lopez is the author of The Farmworker's Journey. She was awarded the Human Agenda Ecological Sustainability Award in 2014. Other awards as well. She has actively been attempting to create awareness about the human rights abuses that are endemic to every juncture of migrant life. Yes, did I tell you she's been at war with Monsanto? Dr. Ann Lopez, there's actually been multiple victories. You've been on the front line for a long time. Let's start with Monsanto. What was it that Monsanto was serving up and has been serving up that's been killing us in the context of the current lawsuit?
Right. Well, I'm happy to be here celebrating three victories that came in very short order after about 8 to 10 years of struggle. And we're celebrating the fact that now Monsanto's Roundup has been called on the platform, so to speak, and that for years people, scientists, have done independent studies showing the connection between exposure to Roundup and glyphosate, which is the active ingredient. It's an herbicide, the most popular herbicide in the world, actually. California used 11 million pounds of glyphosate in 2016.
11 million pounds.
Mm-hmm. 11 million pounds of glyphosate, that's the latest figure, in 2016. It's everywhere. You can imagine with that much exposure. And so basically, one man brought a lawsuit against Monsanto for his case. He's dying of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He was a groundskeeper and claims that because he used so much of it, he has this deadly form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the plaintiff was defended by some very effective attorneys who exposed all the lies in court. And basically, the court ruled that Monsanto should pay him punitive damages to the tune of $289 million.
Is this
one successful lawsuit against Monsanto over glyphosate that I have ever heard of? And there's a new one in the offing in October with 4,000 plaintiffs also sick with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So this is going to put a huge crimp on the sale of glyphosate and Roundup.
Is it used widely, both commercially and, home on the home front?
Absolutely. I mean, people, it's been sold as safe as salt, safe as mother's milk. The data has been manipulated, suppressed, et cetera. And you go into any Ace Hardware, Home Depot, Costco, whatever, and they have big gallon containers of this stuff with no warning. And this has angered me so much because the average life expectancy of a farm worker is only 49 years. And they die oftentimes, probably most often, from cancers. And they're the most exposed population. I've even gone to the extent of making fluorescent labels to put on the containers when I see them. I think the public has a right to know, and I think that selling a product that is sold as safe and then in which exposure could kill you is unethical and unconscionable.
And talk a little bit about the specific problem when it comes to farm workers and their children and where their schools are. I mean, this has been a part of the battle.
Right. Well, we also, our second wind, well, I have identified, well, first of all, before we leave Roundup, I would suggest that parents call on their schools to remove Roundup and any glyphosate-containing products from school integrated pest management plans. You don't want your children or anyone else exposed to glyphosate. And as far as farm workers are concerned, I have identified over the years that I've worked with the community two ways in which farm workers are prevented from becoming educated and successful academically. One is by being exposed to an insecticide called chlorpyrifos. And this pesticide is a potent neurotoxin. If children are exposed to it, it damages their developing brains and spinal cords. And so it was banned from residential use, I believe, in 2001, but it's perfectly fine to use it in agriculture, or it has been. And what happens is in the Salinas Valley, we have some of the worst environmental racism I've ever even heard about. And chlorpyrifos is one of the culprits. It's used in the fields within a quarter of a mile of schools. It's drift prone. In fact, some studies show it can drift as much as 4 miles. And there are hundreds of schools within a quarter of a mile of this chemical being used. And these children are being exposed. And Latino children are 320% more likely to attend the schools with the most hazardous pesticide combinations. So if you don't have a brain that can develop normally, how are you supposed to be successful in school?
Well, that's a very good question, a question you've been asking for a long time, Dr. Lopez.
Win is that we had a federal court case here, and the judge ordered the Environmental Protection Agency to bar within 60 days any use of Dow's chlorpyrifos. So that, to me, is very exciting. I'm sure there'll be blowback from Dow and the Trump administration, and we need to at least convince the state, which is the largest agricultural state, not to reinstate it. But at least it will give these children a fighting chance for a better life with a decent, developed brain.
Wasn't that there were plans to ban it under the federal EPA under the last administration, right? One of the first things the new administration came in and did was to undermine that ban after all of the incredible and powerful research, right?
Right. That's right. That's right. It was due, the EPA was due to ban it. I think the date on that was going to be March 31st, 2017. And then the Trump administration appointed Scott Pruitt as EPA director, and he talked to the Dow executives and reversed the ban. And so every day that that stuff is used, more children's brains are affected. I think it's, again, unconscionable.
And there have been some local tragedies in terms of exposures where people took pretty difficult hits in terms of being exposed, not getting the treatment they need, and who knows, you know, the implications now for the failure of the government to protect them.
Well, exactly. I mean, we had, 15 adults in Central California that were hospitalized because of exposure to chlorpyrifos. So it also affects adults. And unfortunately, in the farm worker community, in the state of California, I think the figure is around 75% are undocumented. They live in constant fear of deportation, and they're threatened with blacklisting or deportation. So they're some of the least likely to seek help and complain and do anything to rock the boat, so to speak. And I think that's another part of the tragedy. They're like an unseen labor force in our midst or on the sidelines, marginalized, that really have no rights and no ability to complain, even when their lives are at stake from these awful chemicals.
And what else is happening on the positive side in terms of the resistance and the fight back?
Well, we got the governor's signature on the 2018 budget trailer, which now will give farm workers the right to have their children attend the same school all year round in the state's 24 migrant camps. And this is another fight we've been going through. When I originally did my research and went to the migrant camp and interviewed farm workers, the biggest complaint being there is that they had to come at the end of one school year, which was usually in May, April or May, and then they had to leave at the beginning of another school year, and they were required to move at least 50 miles away if they wanted to return to the camp, and that meant that their children would be enrolled in a minimum of two schools a year. And some of the parents I talked to who went to Mexico had children attending up to four schools in two languages and two cultures every year. No one can be successful academically with that kind of a situation. So we've been fighting to have the 50-mile regulation modified or banned completely, and we now have it so that the parents and children can stay in the school district where their children go to school for the entire school year. In the past, the parents would actually stay in the camp and send their children to a relative or a friend where they could have stable year-round education. And now they don't have to do that. They can actually stay within the district. If they can, you know, if they move out of the camp, rent an apartment or whatever, they can get a waiver and be allowed to move back in.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Ann Lopez, director of the Center for Farmworker Families, based in Felton, California. I wanted to ask you to remind people of sort of the history of this chemistry. A good part of the reason that we have these kind of devastating and dangerous cancer-causing chemicals used in our gardens is because after the war, they wanted to have a peaceful use, if you will, for some of all the structures they invented, the poison gases and whatever, to use in frontline warfare. So part of the deal was that we could throw them on the crops, right?
Right. Well, that's it. Unfortunately, I don't think enough people understand how the biosphere works, how ecology and ecological cycles work. But there have been two very inspiring studies that I read that inspired me tremendously. One was a UN study about agroecological production. Another was a 30-year study by the Rodale Institute, where they have both concluded that if we converted all industrial agriculture to ecological agriculture, regenerative agriculture, overnight, we could feed the entire human species and never use these chemicals. And we'd have a much healthier population, less cancers, less problematic health issues, and certainly the farm workers would have greater longevity. And I just feel we really need a transformation of how we grow our food. These chemicals are deadly. And another principle you learn if you take any biology at all is the fact that all the cell structures within most of the biosphere are modeled on the same design. So what kills one type of cell in one type of organism, whether it's an insect or a human cell, will generalize to many, many different species. And so they're not targeted pesticides per se. You can target them to be, say, herbicides, but look what's happening to the humans who are impacted by glyphosate, a popular herbicide. They are also affected negatively. So you really can't use broadcast poisons and stay within a healthy ecological situation. And I understand now there's so much glyphosate and chlorpyrifos in the environment that it's in everything, even rainwater at this point. And we really need to clean up this mess.
Wow. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dr. Lopez, we haven't spoken since the sort of the Trump version of the deportation nightmare has been unfolded by the current administration. Obviously, Barack Obama set the tone, but Trump put it on steroids in terms of the treatment of farm workers, of undocumented farm workers. In fact, we're talking about the real problem that arises, because if farm workers are exposed these days, if something comes up, people might not even go to the hospital.
That's right. And they don't have health insurance. They're treated, reminds me so much of kind of a combination of slavery in the South and the Jim Crow reconstruction days, if you can't have one person owning the bodies, then you set up a group of policies, institutions, rules, regulations, etc., that keep them trapped in what they're doing and from which escape is nearly impossible. I think good examples are exposure to glyphosate, since they use more of it and are more exposed than anyone else, and also the 50-mile regulation, which guarantees the next generation of farm workers and prevents breaking the farm workers from breaking the cycle of poverty. It's extremely cruel, and I've identified five mechanisms by which farm worker families, the integrity of the family, is assaulted, essentially, and the members are torn apart from one another. Originally from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and if you're interested in how that happened, you can read my book, The Farm Worker's Journey. And then beyond that, we have the 50-mile regulation, which forces parents to send their kids away, or we had it, to live with a relative so they could have consistent education, but the parents miss their children. Now we've got the Trump administration playing around with DACA, so these students, these people that are soon to be professionals, don't know if they're going to be able to stay here or if they're threatened with deportation. Most of them have never even been in Mexico. We've got that one. We have the ever presence of ICE. There are children in schools who can't concentrate because they're afraid they'll go home and their parents will be gone. We've got that. And then the latest barbaric action of tearing children away from their parents at the border, not even keeping track of where the two are located so you can put the family back together. I know of no other ethnic group ever in this society other than during the time of slavery that has been under such assault. I think this is, again, reprehensible. Something needs to be done. We should be outraged. We hear about family values. Well, there are none for the farm workers.
It was a stunning moment when Trump referred to Central Americans, to Mexicans as animals.
Or murderers and rapists. Murderers and rapists. These are some of the kindest, highest quality human beings giving of whatever they have in the face of having absolutely nothing and living in chronic poverty. Working as hard as they can to bring their families together and have their children have a better life. And what would we do without them? Why do we treat them this way when we're completely dependent as a society on their labor? It makes no sense. I just scratch my head and wonder who came up with this system. It's corrupt.
You deal with families all the time. Are people on high alert now? Or are they taking special precautions? Is there sort of like a system now? Are people working out systems to deal with the level and intensity of the roundups, the arrests, the brutalities?
Well, recently, we haven't had any of that, at least in the Watsonville area. Fortunately, I have good contacts who promised to contact me if they heard any inkling that this was going to, any raids were going to happen, so I could get the word out quickly. Also is a website called Migra Watch. I think it's called MigraWatch.com, where anybody who sees the Migra or ICE coming can then notify everybody in the state or at least in the region that this is happening. I have not met any. I've called all of the chiefs of police, deputies, et cetera, and all of them say they don't cooperate with ICE, which is refreshing. So we do what we can, but, you know, what I would propose is that we give these people who work so hard on our behalf we give them at least a temporary visa or something so they don't have to add fear to their poverty. I think it's cruel.
Well, and of course, the Trump administration is moving quickly to get rid of TPS, temporary protective status, and they're not hesitating. We've seen that to deport, actually, to deport people without their children, despite the fact that they have presented very believable cases that they will be in big trouble, face violence and death if they're returned home. That we're going to be reporting this Friday on the caravan that's going to be leaving from Los Angeles and going across the country to call attention to the struggle and to the importance of TPS. And amazingly, the caravan is going to be led by people who are under the TPS status, really risking everything because of what's at stake.
Well, I agree, and I just don't, I mean, what I don't understand is how these people can operate as if they're above the law, do not have, you know, it's just like, let's create it any way we want. I mean, asylum laws are written into some of the legislation connected to the Constitution. Why aren't we following that? What has happened to compassion in America? For other people, for other cultures. Why don't we help these people? Or at the very least, why don't we as a country acknowledge our role in fomenting the violence that is driving them out of their countries and take responsibility for it? You know, that's the thing. It's like people look at the fallout. Like with NAFTA, all the undocumented immigrants coming here, they look at the fallout, but they do not want to see or look at the role the country played in fomenting the fallout, which they disagree with. And until we are willing to look at our country as a source of the issues, not the recipient only, but the source, and take responsibility for that and make corrections and even help the people restructure their societies after they're destroyed, we're always going to have issues. And it's a waste. It's a waste of human integrity and life and quality of life, et cetera, as I see it.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. Dr. Ann Lopez, director of the Center for Farm Worker Families in California. She is emerita professor and has taught courses in biology, environmental science, ecology. And congratulations. You've been in this one 20 years or more fighting Monsanto. So really, it's a good moment.
It is. I think we should all be celebrating.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on Flashpoints today.
I'm only one step ahead of hombre, one step ahead of misery.
You're listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of August 17th, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview from Wednesday's show asking, is Pope Francis trying to put an end to the global scourge of child rape and molestation that has been perpetrated by the Roman Catholic Church for centuries, or is he, like his predecessors, trying to cover it up by any means necessary?
One moment, we're going to introduce you to somebody who's been fighting this battle against the church in Canada, in the United States, and around the world for decades. But first, let's hear an apology from the latest revelations about the Roman Catholic Church and mass rape and molestation. Listen to this apology.
As your bishop, I am deeply saddened by the terrible and sinful incidents included in the statewide grand jury report. I sincerely apologize for the past sins and crimes committed by some members of the clergy. I apologize to the survivors of abuse and their loved ones. For the times when the church did not live up to her call to holiness and did not do what needed to be done, I apologize. I also apologize to you, the faithful of the Diocese of Allentown, for the toll this issue has taken over the years.
And, yeah, we're going to interrupt right there. We've heard those apologies for a long time. And we're going to be talking about what happened there and why this is a pandemic globally. And what the fight looks like that's been taking place for many years against it. But first, I just want to read to you a little bit of the revelations, just one example of the mendicity and the viciousness by which this kind of stuff continued and nobody said anything. This is the Pennsylvania version. Here's an example. The Reverend Augustine Gialla not only preyed on an entire family, abusing five sisters who belonged to St. John the Evangelist Church, but also surreptitiously collected and ingested their urine, pubic hair, and menstrual blood. Gialla's abuse of one of those sisters was especially horrific. The fondling began when she was 18 months and continued until she was 12. Testifying about her abuse was especially traumatic for this victim, who is now an adult. She suffered a panic attack in the grand jury suite, and several months after speaking out, she attempted suicide. The grand jury concluded, as so many times they conclude, that Gialla's abuse could have been stopped much earlier if church leaders had acted on an early complaint. This is just one of over 300 complaints, with people complaining about multiple long-term incidents where they complain, where they reported it and end up getting beaten by their own parents or disinherited by the church. We are troubled by this, and we're going to spend the whole hour dealing with this as a global pandemic. And joining us to talk about it is somebody who has spent a good chunk of his adult life fighting it, and that's Kevin Annett. I want to tell you a little bit something about him. He considers himself a community minister, human rights consultant, and special advisor to the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State. He's an award-winning filmmaker, he's an author, and he's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2013, 2014, and 2015. And, well, we're going to let him tell you a little bit more about his story and what this battle looks like right now. Kevin Annett, welcome back to Flashpoints.
It's great being back. Thanks, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. I know it's a very long story, but could you just give us the thumbnail sketch of your own background and how it led you to really be on the cutting edge, to be the leader of this battle, to call attention to this incredible situation that is a global pandemic?
It started over a quarter of a century for me. 25 years ago now, I was a Protestant clergyman on the West Coast on Vancouver Island, and I began to find among the native people all of these crimes that you're talking about. I had a policy of going on just, you know, working in the community. Every single Aboriginal person I spoke to described how they had either witnessed killings or crimes, rape, the whole gamut in the local Indian schools run by, at the time, my employer, the United Church of Canada. The more I looked into it, the more I realized it was the Catholics, the Church of England. It was widespread. And after a couple of years of me trying to look into this and growing my congregation from 20 to 100 people, I was summarily fired after I discovered that the land stolen by the early missionaries was being sold off by the churches to various logging companies for lots of kickbacks. And, you know, when you step on the toes of big money, that usually seals your fate. So that how it began for me, but it really mushroomed after that, because historically, it's right at the time, we're talking in mid-1990s, it was right at the time in Canada where a lot of the lawsuits were beginning against the churches and the federal government. And, of course, most of these schools were run by the Roman Catholic Church. And soon after I began this campaign, I began to hear invitations from Europe for me to go over there and start to work with people there as well. So after we forced kind of a grudging apology out of the Canadian government in 2008, I began to do a lot of the work in Europe that, you know, involves the Vatican directly. So, you know, it's been quite a journey, but everywhere you look, you find these same crimes and the same kind of cover-up going on.
All right. This is indeed just the tip of the iceberg. I'd like you to talk a little bit about what happened in Pennsylvania and then put it in the context of some of the other incidents that you've investigated.
Well, it's very interesting. The news item on the whole Pennsylvania situation that I'm looking at, a scathing report reveals 300 Pennsylvanian Catholic priests sexually abused over 1,000 children. It makes reference to Pennsylvania State Attorney General Josh Shapiro. And the whole article is about a report. It's not about prosecution. It's not about taking action. It's about simply a report. Now, this smells a lot of like what happened in Canada, where basically the guilty parties got together with the government, indemnified themselves legally. And it's interesting, the same article says that the Pennsylvania bishops all endorsed the release of the report. Well, they did the same thing in Canada. There's no way church lawyers would allow that endorsement to go on unless there had been an indemnification agreement. And that's the same thing that happened in Ireland. It happens all over the world. Basically, the church government lawyers sit down and they draft an agreement whereby no major figure in the church will be prosecuted criminally for any of these things. And it'll be confined to sexual and physical assault. And after that, there can be all the reports and discussions you would like, but nobody's going to go to jail over it. And that, in fact, was evident. The William Lynn trial a few years ago in Philadelphia, the first Monsignor in America to ever go to trial for covering up child abuse and trafficking within the Catholic Church. Over a quarter of the Philadelphia diocese priests were actively trafficking children. The prosecutor wanted to name the Pope as a third party, but the Obama administration wouldn't allow that diplomatically because and here's the thing, kind of the bottom line for all of this, Dennis, the Catholic prelates are supposed to cover it up. It's a standing church policy called crimen solicitanus. It's a law governing every Catholic in the world. It goes back to 1929. It says when children are raped, the police are not to be told. It's to be kept in-house, and everyone is to be silenced. It's called the pontifical secret. It's an order coming directly from the Pope saying no one is to talk about it or you'll be excommunicated. So literally the philosophy in the Catholic Church is it's not a crime to rape a child. It's a sin which can be forgiven. A crime is to talk about it. It's the law of silence. It's like in the mafia, the omerta. You know, and so that's why when people say, you know, how come these crimes go on and on? It's because it's set up to carry on and on. And that's kind of the general picture.
Now, I'm looking at sort of an overview, and one report says the grand jury report accuses so this went before the grand jury, report accuses 37 priests from the Diocese of Allentown of having sexual contact with minors, including grooming and fondling of genitals or intimate body parts, as well as penetration. The report says the diocesan administrators, including bishops, had knowledge of this contact and yet placed priests in ministry after complaints had been made. The report also says the diocese settled with an unspecified number of victims, and it accuses officials of dissuading victims from contacting the police. And this is a two-way street with you got the priests and the Catholic Church on the one hand, and then you got the police on the other hand. They're collaborating to keep this silence.
Well, they have to under their own laws. And the thing to realize is this crimen solicitanus law under so-called canon law supersedes the laws of America. To a Catholic priest, his first loyalty is to Rome. In effect, it's an act of treason because it's telling every Catholic in America to subvert the child protection laws, to subvert the Constitution and the rule of law in America, not to tell police and to help child rapists get away with it. So, I mean, you know, it's a political question. It isn't simply a few bad apples. The whole system is designed to do this.
What if these young women tried to fight back, tried to complain? Ultimately, she went to the priest, to the bishop. The bishop called the young girl's father. The father came in and ended up believing the bishop, thinking it never happened, and beat the hell out of the kid.
Right.
Is this typical?
That's very common. In fact, it gets a lot worse than that. In Vancouver, where I worked for a long time, there's still a policy. It's called the Baby for Adoption Protocol. And basically, when a Catholic girl gets pregnant and she's not married, she's talked to by her family and the local priest or bishop. And she's convinced to surrender her baby to the local Catholic Church. Catholic doctors are brought in to do the delivery, and they never see their baby again. And these babies are earmarked for trafficking within Catholic orphanages system, the foster care system. They make a lot of money in baby trafficking. That's, in fact, one of the ways that the present Pope Francis won his position within the Argentine church, because he was working with the military junta during the dirty wars, not only providing them positive, you know, a public relations image, but trafficking the children of political prisoners being held. The same thing happened in the Franco dictatorship in Spain. I worked with in Barcelona survivors of this. They were taken from their real parents, who were thrown in Franco's prisons, and then trafficked into Catholic families, and they never knew who their real parents were. The Catholic Church makes millions every year doing this, billions probably. And so it's part of a whole bigger system of child trafficking, really.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Kevin, could you step back a little bit and talk about some of the struggles that you've had in Europe that actually have, you've committed civil disobedience, you've been arrested for trying to call attention to this, for trying to bring it up in Rome, in Great Britain. So give us a little sense of that battle. What has been happening? Take us through your life in that kind of resistance.
Well, it really started in 1995 when you know, it's kind of like a ripple effect. I lost my family. The United Church at the time helped my wife divorce me and take my children from me. It's kind of a standard response to whistleblowers, where you go after the family, you make sure that they're not employable. I've been on blacklist for many years. But it expanded from there when I persisted, especially when I got to Europe. Not only arrested, I was deported from England in 2011. Right after we began, and by we, I mean a network in Canada of Native and non-Native people who were working outside the government system to document independently a lot of the missing children, we had been invited by Mohawk elders in Ontario to start a forensic dig at a mass grave site at the oldest Indian school in Canada, the Mohawk school, and with a working with Don Ortner at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, we confirmed that the bones that had been unearthed by our archaeologists, in fact, were human. Soon after that, I was invited to England to speak, and I wasn't let into the country. I was held at Stansted Immigration Prison, fingerprinted and photographed and deported after a day. And similar kinds of things have happened all over in Italy. You know, especially the closer you get to this crime, the more you face this kind of opposition. But it's kind of an unrelenting attack on anyone who goes outside the official narrative and says, no, this isn't just about individuals. This is a whole system at work historically that's been responsible for genocide and ongoing crimes against children. So unfortunately, the effect of this is that, you know, there's a permanent kind of misinformation campaign all over the internet about the work we do. And, you know, it's part of the whole concealment operation that goes on when there's a lot of crime to conceal.
Tell us about why you co-founded the International Common Law Court of Justice. What is it? Why did you found it? And what has, really, what's the purpose?
Well, it came out of the tribunal we formed, the ICCCS, International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, founded in Dublin in the summer of 2010. The founding groups were mostly survivors of Catholic Church crimes in Europe, and 2 years later, it was realized that under international law, when courts are seen to be complicit in the concealment of crimes, people have the right to form what are called tribunals of conscience and can sit as a court. They can act as a court of record. They can issue subpoenas. They can put various people on trial. And the verdict of that court can be acted upon by other courts. And so what was interesting is the first case we convened in 2012, it lasted 6 months. It used a lot of the evidence we'd come up with in Canada, the hard evidence people can read online at murderbydecree.com. And on the basis of that, after 5 months, a verdict of guilty was brought by 58 citizen jurors against Pope Benedict, Queen Elizabeth, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, those who were found to be directly complicit in these crimes of genocide and child trafficking. What was interesting was that same month that the verdict came in, Pope Benedict resigned. And we knew that was the result of the work we're doing because the Spanish government had issued a diplomatic note 5 days before Ratzinger resigned, saying that based on what they had seen from our evidence, they might issue an arrest warrant if Ratzinger ever came to Spain, since he was actively ordering bishops to hide not only child rape, but actual child trafficking networks within the Catholic Church, involving very high officials, including Ratzinger himself. So it shows you the power of these courts. And, you know, within America, you know, in the grand jury system, the community sheriffs, there's the remnants of that kind of common law sense that the people themselves are the source of sovereignty. And we can convene our own investigations that have teeth in them.
Now, we have seen a lot of positive fanfare and support for Pope Francis. I want to talk a little bit more. He's on his way he's on his way to your homeland, I guess. And I want to talk a little bit about why there seems to be some such fury, even though many of us see him portrayed as a hero. You quote in your piece about his upcoming trip, I guess he's on his way to Dublin. He's on his way to Ireland. You actually quote a priest, one priest, who says, "I pray every day for the Pope to die. He's the greatest threat to the church in its history." That's right. Quoting a cardinal. That's Cardinal Raymond Burke. Tell us about the real Pope. Isn't he fighting? My impression was, just looking at the corporate press, is that he's fighting against this problem that the church has, and he's trying to expose it. He got rid of the former Pope. It was the first time in history that Pope Ratzinger, in this case, retired before he died. Or in a long time.
Right. Well, don't forget, Dennis, that in any corporate spin operation, you need to create a contrast. And in fact, anyone looks good if they followed somebody who's very odious. So anyone after Joseph Ratzinger would look good. Just like after George Bush, she had Barack Obama come in, and there was the assumption that, well, automatically he's going to make things better, when in fact that didn't happen. And he turned out to be as much pro-industrial, military-industrial complex as any other president. Well, the same happens in Rome. There's no evidence that Jorge Bergoglio, or Pope Francis, is in any way a reformer. There's the contrived media spin around him. But when you look at his history in Argentina, when you look at his actual statements to bishops, and his standing by the policy of crimen solicitanus, he's really no different than any other pope, because he's a figurehead. He's not allowed to be different. He can make all the statements he wants, but you notice time and again, whenever he makes a statement, somebody in the College of Cardinals will disavow the statement. Now, that's never happened in papal history before, and it often raises the question, is this guy actually the Pope? Does he have the authority, or is he just kind of a hand puppet being held up there for the Vatican spin operation? But either way, the reality is that if he was genuinely reformer, he would have revoked crimen solicitanus. He would have said, yes, priests who rape children should be brought to trial. There should not be one law for the church and one law for everybody else. None of that is going on, and in fact, he's just the kind of thing that you saw in Canada after the apology, where there was a pretense of reform when, in fact, nothing really had changed.
How, explain his actions in the context of the power of the Vatican Bank.
Well, that's another interesting thing because, you know, follow the money, they often say. And what, if you remember the case of John Paul I in 1978, who lasted 28 days in office and then he was found dead. Well, one of his first acts had been to try to investigate the Vatican Bank and, you know, its ties to the mafia and its money laundering operations. But what's significant about the Vatican Bank is that it is really a repository for a lot of stolen funds all over the world. Last year I was in Serbia working with survivors of the Croatian genocide, where the Ustashi had, during the 1940s, had killed almost a million Serbs at the direct order of the Vatican, Pope Pius in Rome. And a lot of that money was stolen from the Jews and the Serbs and the Romani people who had been killed in the Jasenovic death camp. All went to the Vatican Bank. We found that Pope Francis has helped to engineer a lot of the Russian oligarchy, you know, when they cleaned out the Russian treasury after the fall of the Soviet Union. Interestingly, a lot of that money was laundered and sent into the Vatican Bank. So there's a theory that's come out of Rome that, in fact, the attempt by the Ratzinger faction to restore Pope Benedict to power is, in fact, being backed by Russia because they want their money back. And Bergoglio has done his best to make sure that the Vatican, the old crew in the Vatican Bank, stay in the saddle. So, you know, you've got to make a distinction between the media gestures that are done, like they'll occasionally depose one particular individual, but look at how the system itself is kept intact. And that's really the purpose of any pope is to do that. Otherwise, he won't last very long.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to have Kevin Annette joining us from British Columbia. We're talking about the struggle against the church. Well, he started in Canada with the church there, then the Roman Catholic Church, and Kevin has been fighting this battle since the 1990s, and a courageous battle it is. But let's talk a little bit more now about what exactly is being done to stop this international scourge that is devastating the lives and has devastated the lives of tens of thousands of young people.
Well, officially very little because, you know, again, we find time and again, I've been through so many attempts of this in Canada and America where your survivors go to court. They're immediately restricted by the political situation, which is that the Vatican cannot be put on trial. The actual authority figures that are ordering these cover-ups and everything are beyond the law. And so people are immediately given, victims are given the option. You can accept money in return for a gag order where you can't talk about anything. And it's interesting that tape you played at the beginning of that bishop, four times you use the word apology. Well, the word apology in English has a double meaning. It can mean regret for one's actions. It can also mean to defend one's actions, like an apologetic. And in the context of how government and church leaders use the word apology, it's definitely with the understanding that they are saying that we are defending our actions, we're not liable for anything by issuing this apology, and we're indemnified by making this statement. No one has ever gone to trial in Canada for the death of over 50,000 Native children in these mostly Catholic-run schools, any more than they have in America. So you run up against this controlled legal system, heavily politicized legal system, where the institution itself cannot be put on trial, only individuals can be, and the best you can hope for as a victim is to bit of money and some apology, and that's supposed to fix things. So people get very frustrated. They drop out. They kill themselves. They face an enormous frustration trying to get justice in the system. That's why we've said to people, you have to create that justice for yourself by convening these common law tribunals, by making this citizen arrest against known child raping priests, by mobilizing the community to defend their children. Because frankly, even if you've got an honest cop or lawyer, they're hamstrung and controlled by the system.
Again, we're speaking with Kevin Annette, who has spent a lifetime fighting, calling attention to this incredible situation. And every week, it seems, or every month, there's another revelation. And then every so often, there's a huge release of information. But everybody's, you know, sorry, Kevin, but nobody's going to be prosecuted again, are they? And they say it's too old. All the charges are too old. The people are dead or gone or it's irrelevant. But believe me, it's not going to happen again. That's where it is, isn't it?
Well, exactly. It's like a Native friend of mine on Vancouver Island once told me, you know, an apology is like somebody stealing your car and then knocking at the door and saying, gee, I'm sorry, and then getting in the car and driving away. That's exactly the situation we're facing, that the words are designed to screen the perpetrators so it can carry on.
We're talking about the latest revelations about, well, the Catholic Church and this extraordinarily troubling, decades-old struggle to restrain the church from being the cover for it's almost like, Kevin, the Catholic Church was invented to protect child molesters.
Carried right in the philosophy of original sin, where child, I remember when my two daughters were born, I helped deliver them, and I remember holding them and just the wonder in their eyes, the absolute openness and beauty. You're looking at the universe through their eyes. It's just complete majesty. And I'm thinking, how could anyone in the right mind consider this child fallen or full of sin? It's a very warped belief, and it justifies all sorts of violence historically. And, you know, you could say that traumatizing children at a young age is really the basis of how any elite rule, because if you've got a traumatized population, it's easy to impose anything on them. I think it serves that political purpose for the church to have done this over the centuries, and it's many centuries, and it's not just against children, as you know. It's against, you know, many laws that are still in the books in the Vatican say if you're not a Catholic, you don't have the right to live. You don't have a soul. We can take your land. We can kill you. You know, the Pope has power of life and death over everyone on the planet. They actually believe that. So naturally they're going to spurn law and decency, you know, and it's inevitable from the philosophy. So, you know, it's not surprising at all that these crimes would follow. And when you've got billions of dollars at your disposal, you can prevent any you know, rectification of that.
Amazing. All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Before we let you go, talk a little bit. Your recent pieces about the Pope on his way to your hometown for the place of your in Ireland, which you have a strong affiliation with. What are some of the people saying there? How is he being received? Is he welcome there?
Well, the media says
it always looks like there's a lot of people who are out there cheering for him.
But in fact, there's a lot of discontent in Ireland, just like all third world countries. There's amazing discontent. Like in Chile, the Mapuche Indians burned down 22 Catholic churches last year, and there were big protests when Bergoglio came to town. There's similar protests being planned at Phoenix Park in Dublin, where he's going to do the Mass on the 26th. There's going to be an attempt by some groups to confront him for former citizens' arrest. There's a lot of discontent among the Irish, as always. And, you know, you're going to see that manifested. Only the alternative media will report this, of course, because the corporate media is very much walking lock and step.
So, but what do you, I mean, it seems as though there's a lot of security to protect him from the people who love him. They're doing a bang-up job on security there.
Well, exactly. There's the contradiction. If they all love him so much, how come they've had more military and police protection around this one pope for this upcoming visit than in any of the previous papal visits in supposedly a loyal Catholic nation? That simply isn't the case. And, you know, I think we'll see that once we get some accurate reporting on the ground, which we hope to organize. Dennis, you mind if I mention to folks that I'm...
Go on.
I just wanted to mention that I'm actually... scheduled to speak not far from you folks.
You got 10 seconds.
Okay, September 30th, Sunday, in Fairfield, California, at the Civic Center Library at 1 o'clock. But you can write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com, and itccs.org will have more information about all of that.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at DennisJBernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part one of a fine talk by historian Howard Zinn. It's on war, social justice, and the power of the people. I hope you'll stay tuned. Howard Zinn was a very good historian, for many years a professor at Boston University. His politics were left of center, but they never fit clearly into any one ideology. Zinn did insist the one thing he definitely was not was a liberal. Right on. He is best known for his very popular book, A People's History of the United States, published in 2007. Zinn writes in a simple, clear, plain style. The real interest in his writing is the content. As a historian, he focuses on the lives of normal people, not the elites. The constant struggle of normal people for economic and social justice. His writing also shows the people constantly organizing to fight back against the system, and sometimes winning. Exciting stuff. Stuff they would never teach you in school. Alas, Zinn died in 2010. Today, we will hear part one of a talk Zinn gave late in his life. Part one of three parts total. He spoke in Binghamton, New York, on November 8, 2008. That's 3 days after Barack Obama was elected to be president. Zinn had supported Obama, but Zinn is disturbed by Obama's militarism, his indifference to social justice, and his subservience to Wall Street at the expense of the people. In any case, for Zinn, real social change always comes from the people organizing themselves and compelling change, not from politicians or political parties. Zinn's talk is titled, The Power to Change. Here is part one.
Thank you. Thank you. Since I'm here, I may as well speak. May even speak on the topic that I'm supposed to speak about, which is war and social justice. Did you know that's what I'm going to speak about? Well, it doesn't matter. That's what I'm going to speak about, whether you like it or not. Okay? I don't know if you noticed it in the recent presidential campaign. War was not number one on the agenda of the presidential candidates. Did you notice that? It wasn't. It sort of was there in the background. Oh, yeah, there's a little war going on. Oh, yeah, there are two wars going on. But we'll talk about something else. We'll talk about economic issues. We'll talk about, well, remember, that's what the candidates talked about, right? They talked about health and the reform, and they talked about taxation, and you know, they talk about economic troubles and things like that, you know. And somehow, you know, the war was missing in a campaign. And the question is, you know, why? And I think one reason is that it's easier to talk about issues of social justice, especially if what you talk about is not really concrete. If things are complicated and ambiguous, if both candidates present health plans which the average person cannot really easily distinguish one from the other. So easier to do that, easier to talk about that. But I want to talk about social justice, and I want to talk about war, and I want to talk about the connection between the two. And my starting point for talking about social justice is to ask, well, you know, what really would constitute social justice, or what would constitute a real agenda for social justice? And this is not something that the candidates used as their criteria. I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You may know that this year is 60th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights. The Declaration of Human Rights was adopted in 1948, a few years after the end of World War II. Eleanor Roosevelt was very, very important in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And if you get a chance, take a look at it. It's not hard to find it, right? Google. Google is the answer to everything. Yeah, Google the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You'll see many, many parts of it. But fundamentally, what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, and well, you go right to number 25, right? And it'll say that everybody on the planet has a right to housing, health, food, health care, education. Everybody on the planet has an equal right to all of those things. Well, that's a tall order. In order to achieve that, you'd have to go a long way from where we are. And you'd have to suggest a lot more bolder programs than were suggested by either of the two candidates. I know you may be wondered why I keep talking about the two candidates almost as if they were both doing the same thing. They weren't exactly doing the same thing, no. And Obama was saying more and better than McCain. And well, there are many reasons why Obama was preferable to McCain. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it. You know, but I think both of them fell short, as far as I was concerned, of what they should be doing. But you see, I'm not a politician, right? And it's not the job of the citizen to be a politician. The politician may think that he must moderate and must be careful and must stop short here and stop short there. The citizen should not be doing that. The citizen should not confuse himself, herself, about being a citizen or a politician. The citizen should speak out fully, boldly, clearly on exactly what the citizen thinks is the truth. And then if the candidate is a politician, you know, wants to play with that because it's politically useful, okay, that's their problem. But we, as citizens, have to simply speak our minds. We mustn't be deflected from what we consider to be the truth by the sort of political opportunism and of candidates, what they perceive is a politically necessary thing to do. So, yes, I think our test for social justice should be the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everybody entitled to total health care, free education, food, housing, everybody, you see. Oh, by the way, just as a little aside on social justice, I think I will sort of anticipate what might be a question in a question period and get it out of the way now so I don't have to deal with it later. I anticipate that at some point in the question period, somebody will say to me, well, but what do we do? It always comes up. Why? Because the speaker is speaking in grandiose terms. I always speak in grandiose terms. The speaker is speaking, you know, about larger things. The speaker speaking about the world and the nation and war and peace and all of these really important issues. But the person sitting in the audience saying, okay, enough. But what shall I do? You know, what can I do? So I'm anticipating that question and trying to deal with it now. Because my answer is usually look around you. Look around you at the community. Look around you in the university. Look around you wherever you are. See what's going on. See who's having a problem. Is there an immigrant having a problem? Is there a person having a problem with the police? You know, is there an environmental issue that's come up because some industry has polluted the environment? Look around you. Is somebody being fired unnecessarily? Is somebody being paid lower than minimum wages? Or maybe they're just being paid minimum wages, which are bad enough, right? So that's the kind of thing. And then as I was coming here, or as I was talking to people before coming here, they said, well, you know what's happening on campus, that the food workers are having trouble. Did you know that? The food workers are having trouble with getting their contract renewed because they want to get more than $6 or $7 or $8 an hour. They can't take care of a family on that. Well, there's an issue for you right here. You don't have to go far. You don't have to, you know, right? We all should be helping people around us who need help. It's called solidarity. That's what solidarity is. Yeah. You know, why is all the political rhetoric limited? Why is the set of solutions given to social and economic issues so cramped and so short of what is needed, so short of what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights demands? And so Obama, who obviously is more attuned to the needs of people than his opponent. Obama, who is more farsighted, more thoughtful, more imaginative, why has he been limited in what he is saying? Why hasn't he come out for what is called a single-payer system in health care? You all know what the single-payer system is. It's a sort of awkward term for it, maybe. It doesn't explain what it means, but a single-payer health system means, well, it'll be sort of run like Social Security. It'll be a government system. It won't depend on intermediaries, on middle people, on insurance companies. You won't have to fill out forms and pay, figure out whether you have a pre-existing medical condition. You won't have to go through that rigmarole which has kept 40 million people out of having health insurance. No. Something happens, you just go to a doctor, you go to a hospital, you're taken care of. Period. Government will pay for it. Yeah, the government will pay for it. That's what governments are for. Governments are, you know... They do that for the military. Do you know that? That's what the military has. The military has free insurance. I was once in the military. I got pneumonia, which is easier to get in the military. I got pneumonia. I didn't have to fool around with deciding what health plan I'm in and what, No, I was totally taken care of. I didn't have to think about money. There's a million members of the armed forces who have that. But when you ask that the government do this for everybody else, they cry, that's socialism. Well, if that's socialism, it must mean socialism is good. Right? I was really gratified when Obama called for let's tax the rich more and let's tax the poor and middle class less. And I said, that's socialism. And I thought, whoa, I'm happy to hear that. Finally, socialism is getting a good name. You know, socialism has been given bad names, Stalin and all those socialists, so-called socialists. They weren't really socialists, but, they called themselves socialists, but they weren't really, you see. And so socialism got a bad name. It used to have a really good name. Here in the United States, the beginning of the 20th century, before there was a Soviet Union to spoil it, you see, socialism had a good name. Millions of people in the United States read socialist newspapers. They elected socialist members of Congress and socialist members of state legislatures. There were like 14 socialist chapters in Oklahoma. Really? Socialism. Who stood for socialism? Eugene Debs, Helen Keller, Emma Goldman, Clarence Darrow, Jack London, Upton Sinclair. Yeah, socialism had a good name. It needs to be restored. And so but Obama, with all of his goodwill, intelligence, all those qualities that he has, and so on, you feel that he has a certain instinct for people in trouble, but still, he wouldn't come out for a single-payer health system. That is for what I would call health security to go along with social security, you see. Wouldn't come out for that. Come out for the government creating jobs for millions of people, because that's what really is needed now. You see, when the newspapers this morning report highest unemployment in decades, right? The government needs to create jobs. Private enterprise is not going to create jobs. Private enterprise fails. The so-called free market system fails again and again. When the Depression hit in the 1930s, Roosevelt and the New Deal created jobs. Millions of people. There were people on the, out there on the fringe who yelled, socialism. Didn't matter. People needed it. If people need something badly and somebody does something for them, you can throw all the names you want at them. It won't matter, you see. But that was needed in this campaign. Yes. Instead of Obama and McCain joining together, I know some of you are maybe annoyed that I'm being critical of Obama, but that's my job. That's a citizen, I like him, I'm for him, I want him to do well, I'm happy he won, I'm delighted he won, but I'm a citizen. I have to speak my mind, okay? Yeah. And, but when I saw Obama and McCain sort of both together supporting the $700 billion bailout, I thought, uh-oh. No, please don't do that. Please, Obama, step aside from that. Do what I'm sure something in your instincts must tell you that there's something wrong with giving $700 billion to the same financial institutions which ruined us. We got us into this mess. Something wrong with that, you see. And it's not even politically viable. That is, you can't even say, I'm doing it because people will then vote for me. No. It was very obvious when the $700 billion bailout was announced that the majority of people in the country were opposed to it. Instinctively, they said, something is wrong with this. Why give it to them? We need it. That's what the government, Obama should have been saying. No, let's take that $700 billion. Let's give it to people who can't pay their mortgages. Let's create jobs, instead of pouring $700 billion into the top and hoping that it will trickle down to the bottom. No, go right to the bottom where people need it. So, yes, that was a disappointment. So I'm trying to indicate what we'll have to do now to fulfill what Obama himself has promised, change, real change. You can say change, but if you keep doing the old policies, it's not change, right? So what stands in the way of Obama and the Democratic Party, and what stands in the way of them really going all out for a social and economic program that will fulfill the promise of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Well, I can think of two things that stand in the way. Maybe there are more, but I can only think of two things at a time. One of them is simply the great, powerful economic interests that don't want real economic change. Really, they don't. You take in healthcare. There are powerful interests involved in the present healthcare system. People are making lots of money from the healthcare system as it is, making so much money, and that's why the costs of the healthcare system in the United States are double what the healthcare costs are. The percentage, of money devoted to healthcare percentage is double administrative costs in the United States compared to countries that have the single-payer system, because there are people there who is siphoning off this money, who are making money. Their health plans, their insurance companies, their health executives and CEOs, so that there are, their interests, economic interests that are in the way of real economic change. And Obama so far has not challenged those economic interests. Roosevelt did challenge those economic interests boldly, right frontally. He called them economic royalists. He wasn't worried that people would say, oh, you're appealing to class conflict, the kind of thing they pull out all the time, as if there hasn't always been class conflict. It's something new, class conflict. You're creating class conflict. We've never had class conflict. We've always all been one happy family, no. There are these interests standing, in the way. And, unfortunately, the Democratic Party is tied to many of those interests. Democratic Party is tied to a lot of corporate interests. I mean, you look at the people who are on Obama's economics team, and they're Goldman Sachs people, and they're former, people like that, That's not, they don't represent change. They represent the old style democratic, stay put leadership. It's not good. So, the other factor that stands in the way of a real, bold economic and social program is the war. The war, the thing that hadn't, a $600 billion military budget. Now, how can you call for the government to take over the healthcare system? How can you call for the government to give jobs to millions of people? How can you do all that? How can you offer free education, free higher education, which is what we should have, really? We should have free higher education. Well, how can you, you know, No, how can you double teach your salaries? And how can you do all these things which will do away with poverty in the United States? It all costs money. And so where's that money going to come from? Well, it can come from two sources. One is the tax structure. And here Obama been moving in the right direction. When he talked about not giving the rich tax breaks and giving tax breaks to the poor, in the right direction, but not far enough. Because the top 1% of the richest 1% of the country has gained several trillions of dollars in the last 20, 30 years as a result of the tax system, which has favored them. And, you have a tax system where 200 of the richest corporations pay no taxes. You know that? You can't do that. You don't have their accountants. You don't have their legal teams and so on and so forth. You don't have their loopholes. The war, $600 billion. We need that. We need that money. But in order to say that, one, we're going to increase taxes on the super rich much more than Obama has proposed. And believe me, it won't make those people poor. They'll still be rich. They just won't be super rich. I don't care if there's some rich people around. But, we don't need super rich, not when that money is needed to take care of the little kids in preschool and there's no money for preschool. No. We need a radical change in the tax structure, which will immediately free huge amounts of money to do the things that need to be done, and then we have to get money from the military budget. Well, how do you get money from the military budget? Don't we need $600 billion for the military budget? And don't we have to fight two wars? No. We don't have to fight any wars. And this is where Obama and the Democratic Party have been hesitant, to talk about. But we're not hesitant to talk about it. The citizens should not be hesitant to talk about it. If the citizens are hesitant to talk about it, they will just reinforce the Democratic leadership and Obama in their hesitations. we have to speak what we believe is the truth. And I think the truth is we should not be at war. We should not be at war at all. I mean, these wars are absurd. They're horrible. Also, they're horrible and they're absurd.
And here we must pause Howard Zinn's long and fascinating talk, The Power to Change. More to come in the next 2 weeks on New World Notes. For the original recording, thanks to Lynn Gary and the Unwelcome Guests Collective, unwelcomeguests.net. We too have a website with a free archive of our shows, and that address is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again for more of Howard Zinn next week. Peace.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
We're going to start the show today with some good news. Professor Peter Phillips has a new book out called Giants, the Global Power Elite, which will be released in August of 2018. This is what Mark Crispin Miller, a professor of media at NYU, has to say about the book. Peter Phillips thoroughly identifies the members of the transnational capitalist class that largely runs the world today through the mammoth instruments of Western military force and the international intelligence community, and not least, our free press. So there's a new global elite at the controls of our economic future. And here, former Project Censor Director and Media Monitoring Sociologist Peter Phillip unveils for the general reader just who these players are. The book includes such power players as Larry Fink, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, and Warren Buffett. And Peter Phillips names names in the book. And at the end of the book, he includes a letter to the 389 global power elites that he's named in the book. So on today's show, you're going to hear Peter Phillips, a former Project Censor director and media monitoring sociologist and professor, discuss this new book. The speech was given in March of 2018 at a conference as part of the Sonoma State University's fourth annual Social Justice Week, and it was partially sponsored by Project Censored. This video was recorded by Dennis Murphy of Petaluma Community Access. So here he is, Peter Phillips.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Peter Phillips from the Sociology Department here at Sonoma State, and I'm going to talk about the global power elite, the giants of capitalism. And there's a picture that you all have a copy of, and this is the Diego Rivera mural, which now resides in Mexico City, but this is the second copy of it. This mural was first done at the Rockefeller Center in 1934 by Diego Rivera, and Rockefeller didn't like it that he had certain figures in there and destroyed the entire mural. The mural it's called the Man of the Universe, and it seemed appropriate that, one, the Rockefellers had destroyed it, and two, that it's, you know, about a very powerful person. And so that's going to be on the picture of my Global Power Elite book, which will be out in August from Seven Stories Press. Part of the conversation today, too, is about the transnational capitalist class. Estimates are that the world's wealth is about $255 trillion, and with U.S. and Europe holding about two-thirds of that total. Meanwhile, 80% of the people in the world live on less than $10 a day. And the poorest half of the population lives on $2.50 a day. And 1.3 billion people live on $1.25 a day. So there's massive inequality, and 80% of the world is very poor. The LA Times reports this year that 1 out of 9 people go to bed hungry every night. That's 795 million people on the planet who suffer from chronic hunger, and they're forecasting that 2 billion people will be lacking food by 2050. In addition, 1 out of 3 people suffer from some form of malnutrition, which means they lack sufficient vitamins and minerals in their diet that lead to health issues such as stunted growth in children. Each year, poor nutrition kills 3.1 million children under the age of 5. 25,000 people a day, or 9 million a year, die from starvation and malnutrition. This slaughter occurs every day. That's the equivalent of 10 9/11 events every day in the world. Yet we have more than enough people to food to feed everybody. It's not a lack of food. It's a lack of distribution. A quarter of all the food in grocery stores is thrown away. Humanity is divided into the 1%, the upper 1%, and particularly the upper 1,000th of 1%, several thousand people in the very elite group. 20%, which have jobs and incomes and are often described as middle-class working people, professionals. And the 80%, where wealth really doesn't exist at all. The transnational capital elite takes pride in pointing out that they have the largest middle class ever, but that's the 20%. But that doesn't extend down into the rest of the world, and they are getting poorer every day. Oxfam International reported in January of 2016 that only 62 people hold as much wealth as half the world. A year later, that was down to 8 people. So at the beginning of 2017, 8 people controlled more wealth than half the world. And wealth concentration is happening so massively that someday it's very feasible that one person will hold more wealth than half the humans in the world. The top billionaires, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, who's now 100 million and the number one leader in the world, Amancio Ortega from Spain, William Buffett from Berkshire Hathaway, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, Carlos Slim from Telecom in Mexico. Those are the multi-billionaires at 50 billion plus. Forbes lists 2,047 billionaires for 2017. These global capitalist elites are fully aware of their vast inequalities and their rapidly growing concentration of wealth. The billionaires are similar to colonial plantation owners. They know they are a small minority with vast resources and power, yet they must continually worry about the unruly exploited masses rising in rebellion. Understanding how power and inequality is sustained can perhaps give us opportunities for democracy and equality in today's world. Now, there's a long tradition of sociological research that documents the existence of a dominant ruling class in the United States. Elites set policy, determine national political priorities. The American upper class is complex and competitive. It perpetuates itself through interacting families of high social standing with similar lifestyles, corporate affiliations, membership in elite clubs, and private schools. The American ruling class has also long been determined to be mostly self-perpetuating, maintaining its influence through policymaking institutions such as the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the Business Roundtable, the Conference Board, the American Enterprise Institute, Council of Foreign Relations, and a number of other policy groups that are U.S.-oriented. These associations have long dominated policy decisions in the U.S. government. In 1956, C. Wright Mills wrote his book called The Power Elite, which was how World War II solidified a trinity of power in the United States that comprised corporate, military, and government elites in a centralized power structure motivated by class interests and working in unison through higher circles of contact and agreement. Mills described how power elites were those who, quote, decide whatever is decided of major consequence. In the past few decades, especially since 9/11, the policy of the elites have been mostly united in support of American empire military power that maintains a repressive war against resisting groups, typically labeled terrorists, around the world. This war on terror is much more about protecting transnational globalization and capital, dollar hegemony, access to oil, than it is about repressing terrorism or protecting us. The U.S. has a long history of interventions around the globe for the purpose of protecting our national interests. Increasingly, NATO is a partner with the U.S. in this global dominance agenda, reflecting increasing transnational economic natures of our interests. Now, when we say national interests, I think it's important to kind of specify what does that mean. Robert Blackwell, who is a Kissinger senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and national security advisor to George Bush, clearly stated in an article in January of 2017, telling President Trump the importance of defending the U.S. interests. He wrote, in addition to protecting the U.S. from nuclear threats, Blackwell called for ensuring the viability and stability of major global systems, trade, financial markets, supplies of energies, and climate. He said, we must maintain a regional and global balance of power that promotes peace and stability through domestic American robustness, an international policy of primacy in supporting, defending the U.S. alliances, particularly with Israel. Now, so he's saying, we're here to protect business. That's what it's about. The Heritage Foundation has an annual index called Military Strength, and it describes U.S. vital interests as defense of the homeland, successful conclusion of major wars or destabilize a region of critical interest to the U.S., and the preservation of movement within the global commons, the sea, air, and other space domains through which the world conducts business. So the empire, the American empire, and the NATO empire are about protecting business worldwide. Peter Dale Scott writes in his book, The American Deep State, he describes the importance of Wall Street as the overworld that offers intelligence agencies and personnel around the world policies and direction. The U.S. has long been the protector of global capitalism, especially since World War II. We have over 800 bases in 70 countries and territories. The U.K. and France and Russia collectively have only 30 bases that are foreign. The U.S. is now deployed in 70% of the nations in the world. And the Special Operations Command has troops in 147 countries, an 80% increase since 2010. U.S. Special Forces are currently engaged in 100 missions in Africa. Most of these missions are training exercises, but direct action counterterrorism strikes happen regularly, including drone assassination and kill and capture raids. Capital power elites exist around the world. The globalization of trade and capital brings the world elites into increasingly interconnected relationships, to the point that scholars for the past few decades have begun to talk about the development of a transnational capitalist class. One of the earliest works on this topic is the book, The Transnational Capitalist Class, by author Leslie Sklar, economist in London, argued that globalization has elevated transnational corporations to more influential international roles, with the result of nation states being less significant than international agreements developed through the World Trade Organization and other international institutions. Emerging from these multinational corporations is a transnational capitalist class whose loyalties and interests are still rooted in their corporations but are increasingly international in scope. Now, deep inside the transnational class is what David Rothkopf calls, in his book, The Superclass, the global power elite in the world they are making. He is the one that talks about the 1,000th of 1%, the 6,000 to 7,000 people who the Davos-attending, private jet-flying, mega-corporation-interlocked, policy-planning elites of the world, people at the absolute peak of the global power pyramid. They are predominantly white, mostly from North America and Europe, and they are the ones that set the agendas in the G20, the G7, NATO, the World Bank, and the WTO, World Trade Organization. Now, in our research, we identify the people on the boards of directors of the top 17 asset management firms of the world. These firms have in excess of $1 trillion in management. These 17 firms collectively have 199 directors on their boards. We think that this group of 199 individuals represents the financial core of the world's transnational capitalist class. Now, if you look at the chart on the back of the picture I gave you, that's the back of the cover image. There's a chart there that shows you what we call the giants. When I say giants, these are the corporations that managed in excess of $1 trillion in 2017. So many of them are far in excess. They're $4, $5 trillion, $4 trillion, $3 trillion. And the total for those 17 firms is $41.1 trillion. They're only managed by 199 people, so a room twice the size they could all fit in and have cocktails. It's not very many. And what's interesting about these, they're the Western governments and policy boards work in the interest of this financial core to protect the free flow of capital investment anywhere in the world and the continuing returns needed for capital growth. The financial core of the transnational class are the directors of banks and the asset firms that control this $41 trillion. In addition, they also serve many other smaller asset management firms, adding traditional trillions of dollars and more. So if you look at the chart I gave you, it shows you the one with all the squiggly lines, the global giants corporations. Those are the 17, and they control $41 trillion, and they're all invested in each other. So the $41 trillion, $403 billion, is invested in each other. So they're all collectively invested in that this $40 trillion becomes one large, super connected global capital structure managed by less than 200 people. And that's the power of elites today. Now, if you look at the backside of that chart, you'll see that the 17 trillion dollar companies, there's three more new giants that by 2018, have been added into the trillionaires. And then there's nine near giants who are all in excess of $800 billion. So if you put those all together, we're talking about 30 big companies that control in excess of $50 trillion worth of wealth. So we're starting to talk about a quarter of all the wealth in the world concentrated in one place. Now, if you try to think about $1 trillion, I mean, it's really kind of an amazing thing to even think about. The entire U.S. military empire and NATO together, all the bases around the world, all the military wars and things we're doing, does not exceed $1 trillion. So when you talk about 50 times that, managed by just a few hundred people, it's a massive amount of very solid, consolidated wealth that every government institution, every president of European countries, all the intelligence agencies want to protect. That's what American capitalism is about, is protecting that wealth. The top asset firms tend to invest in each other. J.P. Morgan, Chase, and BlackRock, they have this $403 billion invested collectively in each other. The interlock capital is likely much higher. It's probably closer to $2 to $3 trillion, because that $400 billion that we've discovered was only about 25% that NASDAQ publicly lists in terms of co-investments. So 75% of these investments are held privately, and we don't know where they are. So there are many hundreds of transnational capitalist people inside the global empire of capital, but these are the 199 that are the most part of the financial core. They manage the top 17 firms. They have similar backgrounds and similar training. The 136 of them, they're all degreed. 59 have MBAs or PhDs. Almost all attended elite colleges, 28 attended Harvard and Stanford. The people from the 20 nations are made up the financial core. 60% are from the U.S., 23 are from Britain and France each, 13 from Germany and Switzerland each, then 3 from Italy, Singapore, India, Austria, 2 from Japan and Brazil, and then 1 each from Netherlands, South Africa, Zambia, Kuwait, Belgium, Canada, Mexico, Colombia. So it's international. And they all operate in the big cities like New York, Chicago, London, Paris, Munich, or went to college there, Tokyo, Singapore. The members of the financial core take active part in global policy groups. Financial core serve on as advisors to the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Bank of Settlements, the Federal Reserve Board, the G7, and the G20. Most attend the World Economic Forum in Davos. Many of the 199 have been keynote speakers there. So, and the World Economic Forum has been getting more attention. Newspapers will say when it's happening. It's not a policy-making body. It's in Davos, Switzerland, January of every year. 2,000 or 3,000 people go. It's up at 5,000-foot elevation. They pay. This year, I heard it was 50,000. It used to be 25,000. And the top 1,000 corporations in the world are invited to send people. And they can send as many as 5, as long as one is a woman. So that's how they keep a little gender balance there. But it's not a formal policy-making group. There's an educational consensus function, where these thousands of elites in the world, 3,000 attended in 2017, they're getting to hear from top investors and top policy people in the world. The president of China was there last year. And didn't Trump go this year? I think he did. And so it's very personally, it's very enlightening. And, you know, a lot of feeling of, boy, I'm really special because I'm here. I'm in Davos. Kind of the same thing I saw at the Bohemian Grove, where the 2,000-plus men meet every year. And it's just all men there. They don't even have a quota for women. But they don't make policy either. They just get together, applaud each other, hear talks and speeches, and feel good about it all. Transnational elites interact as a class of people. They know each other, often personally. They do business together. And they either know each other personally or know of each other. They have similar educational and lifestyle backgrounds. They share common global interests. They meet in non-governmental policy organizations and form new ones as needs arise to privately make decisions for global governance institutions to implement. Transnational elites hold a common ideology of being the engineers of global capitalism, a firm belief that their way of life and continuing global capital is best for all humankind. The transnational capitalist class represents the interests of several hundred thousand millionaires and billionaires who comprise the richest people in the top 1% of the world's hierarchy. So you may be a multimillionaire, but most of your money you've allowed a management investment firm to hold for you and give you anywhere from a 3 to 10% return. And if you have some that's risky, you may go with a venture capitalist company in the hopes of getting better than a 10% return. Ironically, this extreme accumulation of concentrated capital creates a continuing problem for investors. They have to scour the world for new investment opportunities that will not yield adequate return, that will yield adequate returns on capital. So they got more capital, they got places to invest it in with a positive return. So the concentration of wealth and power at this level tends to overaccumulate in the hands of increasingly fewer elites to the point that capital has limited safe investment opportunities. There are three mechanisms for investing this excess capital. One, they'll do risky financial speculations like the subprime mortgage loans, which almost collapsed the entire system in 2008. They will continually buy up public institutions and try to privatize everything, electric companies, water, roads, schools. I'm waiting for churches to become privatized. Well, in some ways they are. So everything that's part of the public domain, everything in the culture is for sale. And the other big area where capital is used up is the preparation for war and the acting and wars. So wars, they spend huge amounts of money investing in war machines, war protection, armies, and then they blow things up that have to be reinvested and protected. It's a very great profitable way to use capital. So Western governments and international policy bodies serve the interest of the transnational capital class, capital concentrations. Wars are initiated to protect their interests. Uncooperative regimes are undermined and overthrown in support of the free flow of global capital for investment anywhere the returns are possible. So we've seen regime changes and attempted regime changes in Libya, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, Yemen, Afghanistan, the Balkans are all examples of wars to support international capital penetration of the region. There were some blockages before by dictators or government blockages, and that they're seeking to undermine that. And they're seeking very hard to dismantle the democratically elected countries in Venezuela and Cuba, for that matter. And earmarking and surrounding militarily China and Russia. Now, the Chinese have some 80 billionaires, and they are invested in this market, and they are part of the policy planning thing, but they still maintain separate military and nationalistic orientations that don't, the power elite don't like very much. So while millions suffer, the power elites, the financials, they focus on seeking returns in the trillions of dollars, and they'll do this on speculating everything, like food and land. So, and they'll cooperate with each other to control and entrap, and this controls and traps cycles of economic growth with continuing mass humanitarian consequences. So if they're investing in bulk foods, the commodities market, and the prices are going up, for somebody living on $2 a day and the price of whatever commodity they're eating, rice, potatoes, whatever, goes up, that leads to the continuing starvation of tens of thousands of people every day. So war and preparation for war is a major return use of excess capital. For the U.S., that amounts to $600 billion in 2017. It's higher this year. China is $215 billion, Russia $69 billion, but Saudi Arabia, U.K., India, France, Japan, Germany are all in the $40, $50 billion range. South Korea, Italy, Australia, Brazil, Israel are all in the $20 to $30 billion range. So Dwight Eisenhower said in 1953, every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who are hungry and are not fed and those who are cold and not clothed.
And again, you were just listening to Peter Phillips discussing his new book, Giant, the Global Power Elite, coming out in August of 2018. You can pre-order a copy at the website projectcensored.org. And again, that's projectcensored.org. And tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this speech. And just a reminder that my shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four. So radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors, and then look for Cheryl with a C. And then if you click on my name, the show should pop up in chronological order. And today's show should be up there in a few days. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Bankruptcy judge upholds junta's power over island nation, further legitimizing Puerto Rico's colonial status.
Equals death. I'ma cry freedom to my very last breath. Pull up the shades and let the sun shine. Brother, we ain't free while we forced to die. We set the early grace for a lie, but I spit back out, not American pie. Mi Borinque still ain't free to this day. You brought your Trojan gifts and walked away. La Isla de Vieques is still in pain. Boricuas waving the U.S. flag are insane. Yeah, I said it, go ahead and discredit my words with your Fox News media edits. I'ma stay spitting poetic justice. Uncle Sam got his hand out to shake, don't trust it. Colonialism, a country in prison. Commonwealth is an open prison.
Libertad. Dame la libertad o dame la muerte.
Libertad. And now to discuss the latest assault on Puerto Rico and what it means for the island's residents, as a federal bankruptcy judge has upheld a junta's power over the island nation and further codified its colonial status, Ken Nash and I speak with Professor Rafael Bernabe, researcher and professor at the University of Puerto Rico. He's the co-author with Cesar Ayala of Puerto Rico in the American Century, a history since 1898, and is a tireless social justice advocate with the Working People's Party in Puerto Rico. From Puerto Rico, we welcome Professor Bernabe.
Thank you for having me.
So how do you read the significance of the federal bankruptcy court upholding the power of the junta and essentially further codifying the stripping of Governor Ricardo Rassolo and really the legislature of Puerto Rico of any self-determination in its own policies and practices? What do you think this means?
Yeah, well, I think that maybe we should give a little bit of background to the listeners so that they understand what this decision is about. Puerto Rico, as you mentioned, is a colony of the United States. Many of the policies that affect Puerto Rico are taken by the U.S. Congress or departments of the federal government or the president of the United States. And so that situation existed before the creation of the Oversight Board. Beginning in 2016, Congress created, or in 2016, Congress approved the legislation, which is known in Puerto Rico as PROMESA. The full name is Puerto Rico Oversight Management and Stability Act. And this legislation created a junta, a board, an oversight board, or a control board, which is empowered to oversee the financial functioning of the government of Puerto Rico. What that means is that the government of Puerto Rico had to approve a multi-year fiscal plan. It's a five-year plan. And then every budget, every year, has to fit within that fiscal plan. It's a fiscal plan which is very restrictive. It implies very sharp reduction in government spending, public services, the privatization of many services, privatizations of schools, and so on. And but the structure up to the recent decision was that the government of Puerto Rico writes the budget of Puerto Rico, as it normally does, and negotiates with the Junta, with the board. If the Junta disagrees with some aspect of the budget, they negotiate and they come to some sort of agreement. Recently, the Junta was so, let us say, aggressive in terms of the cuts and the measures that it wanted to impose on the government of Puerto Rico that even the government of Puerto Rico, which is not in any way a radical government or even a progressive government, is a very conservative government, was not able to or not willing to agree to some of the measures that the Junta or the board wanted to impose. So they weren't able to come to an agreement. And the board went to court, or the Junta or the board claimed to have the right, to have the power, to, if there was no agreement, to impose its version of the budget. While the government of Puerto Rico argued that the Junta does not have the power to impose a budget, that the government of Puerto Rico still retains the power to approve the budget of the government of Puerto Rico, and that the Junta has to negotiate with the government of Puerto Rico. Well, they went to court, and as you mentioned, the court decided that, yes, the Junta has the right to impose its own version of the budget. So this kind of tightens the screws on the government of Puerto Rico. It was already a colonial situation. It was an accentuated colonial situation with the creation of the board in 2016, and now the powers of the board over the government of Puerto Rico have been increased because of this decision. And needless to say, the policies that the board wants to impose on Puerto Rico and is imposing on Puerto Rico are terrible policies. They are basically based on two premises. One premise is that the fiscal problem of Puerto Rico and the debt problem of Puerto Rico is due to the fact that allegedly the government of Puerto Rico is too big, therefore you have to privatize, therefore you have to reduce public spending and so on. And the other premise of the policies of the Junta is that the problem with the economy of Puerto Rico, the reason why it doesn't grow, is because the workers of Puerto Rico have too many rights, and therefore you have to eliminate and to cut all sorts of labor protections in Puerto Rico. So they are imposing these terrible austerity policies on the island, and they are taking away labor rights, which, needless to say, is impoverishing people in Puerto Rico and is not going to help in any way to solve the present economic crisis.
Well, I was going to ask a question about the recovery from the hurricane and also the question of whether FEMA is at all involved in helping you in these days. But I'd like you to first talk about some of these cutbacks that you were talking about in the anti-labor policies.
I can give you several examples. Where I work, which is the University of Puerto Rico, is a very good example. The government is planning and is already implementing to cut the budget of the government of the University of Puerto Rico by half. It's not reducing it by, 10% or 20%, by half. And at the same time, they are increasing the tuition fees that students have to pay. They are not only increasing them, slightly, they are doubling them. They are duplicating them. Students will have to pay the double amount of money that they used to pay in order to study at the university. And at the same time, they are attacking and reducing many gains of working people in the university, sick leave and pensions and so on and so forth. So they are attacking the workers of the university, they are attacking the students in the university, and they are slashing the budget of the university. Another terrible example, another very dramatic example, is the policy being followed in the public school system. There they are following a policy of closing schools. They have closed about 250 schools since last May. We are now beginning the new school semester this week, and there are 250 schools less than there were last May, which has created a terrible situation in which the schools that are supposed to receive the students whose schools have closed are not really ready to receive all of these students or the teachers. It's a very chaotic situation. In fact, teachers are going to have a one-day strike Wednesday, tomorrow, in order to protest, react against this terrible situation. Other policies that are being followed is the privatization of services. They are seeking the privatization of the electrical system, which has many problems, but we don't think that privatization is going to solve any of them. So, you know, they are going in that direction. The board, not so much the government of Puerto Rico, the board is insisting on eliminating many labor protections in Puerto Rico. The biggest measure that they want to approve, the most important one, is they want to revoke, they want to eliminate legislation which in Puerto Rico is known as Law 180, which is a legislation that somewhat protects workers against firings. In Puerto Rico, in order to fire a worker, you have to have one of several reasons indicated in this legislation, which means that workers evidently can be fired in Puerto Rico, but you have to follow certain procedures. If you don't follow them, then the employer may be, you know, may be fined or may have to pay compensation to the worker affected by this decision.
And that's something we can use here in the United States. And the mainland also, which we
don't have. Yeah, they want to. What they want to establish is what you call in the United States, I think it's called employment at will, which is that they can fire you anytime without any hesitation or compensation and so on. And using, in fact, the argument that this is what exists in many states of the United States, they want to revoke this labor protection legislation in Puerto Rico. This is one of the things that the junta wants to do. This is one of the things that people are very much attached to, and they think it's a very important labor protection. And the government of Puerto Rico, as I said, reactionary and conservative as it is, has hesitated in approving this or going along with the junta on this request. This has been one of the issues of some sort of conflict between the junta and the government, which exists. And so right now, as I said, we are facing privatization policies. We are facing cutbacks in services. Another measure which has a terrible effect is the fact that they are reducing pensions of government workers. You know, depending on the size of the pension, it's a 10%, 20%, 30% reduction. But pensions in Puerto Rico are already very low, so that if you reduce pensions, then you basically are sending a lot of people under the poverty level because they are already on the edge of that. And you know, 10% or 20% reduction in their pensions would push them over the edge into, you know, a situation of need. So whether it's people who are already in retirement, whether it's students in universities, students in the public school system, workers in the government or workers in the private sectors, everybody is being somehow affected by these terrible austerity policies, which, as I said, they are not only bad in terms of impoverishing people, but they are even worse because they are impoverishing people to no purpose. You said we are sacrificing in order to bring the country out of its present economic crisis. Well, maybe, but not even that. We are sacrificing in order to perpetuate the present economic depression.
And obviously the exacerbation of the condition of the people of Puerto Rico by virtue of the fact that the Hurricane Maria, but of course that the resources have never been there to rebuild the island. But at this time, is there any more cohesive strategy, Professor, or are people still kind of in their silos working around their particular issue, whether it's in education, whether it's in the university context, in the power sector grid, you know, et cetera, being privatized? Or has there come about more of a collectivization that also results in really an examination of the status of Puerto Rico politically, which allows for this complete boot on the neck by the U.S. government and its PROMESA Act legislation?
Yeah, as several things about that. First of all, as you point out, the situation of Puerto Rico was already very bad, very dire, very complicated before Hurricane Maria. Hurricane Maria accentuated many of the problems that already existed. Just to give you a raw figure, the damage caused by Maria has been estimated at around $90 billion. Puerto Rico's gross domestic product, you know, is about $100 billion. So it's a very significant amount, $90 billion. It's more than the debt of Puerto Rico. This is one of the reasons why there is a movement, and I, you know, I'm part of that movement, who that argues that the Puerto Rico, the debt of the government of Puerto Rico, which was already unsustainable before Hurricane Maria, which you cannot pay without imposing on the Puerto Rican people terrible sacrifices for many years, unacceptable sacrifices, and condemning the economy to further, as I said, depression for many years, that this debt, which was already unsustainable before Maria, now it's quite simply unpayable. It has to be canceled. There's no way that an impoverished country that has suffered a disaster such as Maria can be asked to pay a $73 billion debt. It's just an immoral act. It is this debt has to be canceled. And there are many good legal arguments for that. You know, the doctrine of change of circumstance, when the circumstances of a debtor change by situations that are under his or her control, they have a good reason to, they have a good argument to have part of that debt or that whole debt canceled. In the same fashion, there's the doctrine of state of necessity. When a government, in order to pay a debt, would have to stop carrying out the tasks that it has to, you know, the duties that it has to protect people and the health of people and security of people, then it has the good argument to cancel that debt. But anyway, as you point out, there are many struggles in Puerto Rico going on. There's the labor movement. There are initiatives to revive Puerto Rican agriculture. There are movements to defend the environment, which is another aspect of the policies of the government, and they're trying to sell many natural resources of Puerto Rico as part of their conception of how to bring out Puerto Rico out of the present crisis. So there's the environmental movement, there's the student movement, there's a very lively women's movement at this moment in Puerto Rico, and the labor movement, and so on. And I think that we're all struggling in the same direction. I would say that we still have to go some further steps in order to organize, as you point out, a more coordinated, a more collective resistance to the junta. Unfortunately, right now, still, I would say, you know, we are a little bit too fragmented, more fragmented than we should be. You know, the unions are doing some work, the environmentalists are doing some work, the women's movement is doing some work. It's all good work, but it has to be coordinated in a better fashion so we can have a unified, coherent response to what the junta and the government want to impose on Puerto Rico.
And at this point also, I'm wondering as to whether there are specific actions that people on the mainland should be backing up our sisters and brothers. For example, should we continue to plow ahead with the cancellation of the Jones Act, which was temporarily suspended? Are there other kinds of things that we can be doing to support the activities of our sisters and brothers on the island?
Yeah, well, I think that there are many institutions or persons that need to receive the message about Puerto Rico. There's Congress. We need to demand that Congress recognize its responsibility for the situation in Puerto Rico. As you said, Congress has maintained Puerto Rico in a colonial status for more than a century now. Congress has maintained Puerto Rico in a situation in which it cannot really develop its economy. There are, and I could list many measures taken by Congress that have hindered Puerto Rico's economic development. And Congress has to recognize that responsibility, and it should assign a significant amount of money to reconstruct Puerto Rico's economy. This is not different from many what poor people and working people need in the United States. Sometimes people ask me, you know, why should Congress assign, you know, $5 billion to reconstruct Puerto Rico when it doesn't do that in the United States or in many regions of the United States? And my answer to that is that it should do that in the United States as well, because poor people and working people in the United States need major federal programs, you know, to create jobs, to fix infrastructure, to provide housing, and so on. So we need to demand that Congress assign considerable amount of funds for Puerto Rico's reconstruction. And we need to pressure the creditors of Puerto Rico, the bondholders, the people who hold the debt of Puerto Rico, so that they know that what they are doing is a terrible thing. What they are trying to impose on Puerto Rico is something that must be rejected. Many of these bondholders have, you know, offices in Wall Street and in New York and in other places. And we also have to put pressure on Judge Laura Taylor Swain, which is the judge, the federal judge in New York, who is in charge of the negotiations regarding Puerto Rico's debt. And we have to let this judge know, you know, and we can have mobilizations, we can pickets, we can have, you know, we can write letters to her or whatever. We have to let this judge know that the debt of Puerto Rico cannot be paid, that it should not be paid, that it would be criminal to continue trying to collect a payment for this debt on a people who are already impoverished and who have gone through this terrible experience of Hurricane Maria. So, you know, Congress, the federal courts, and the creditors, those three entities need to hear from us in Puerto Rico and from all our friends in the United States so that they get a message that Puerto Rico needs funds to reconstruct our economy, Puerto Rico needs the debt canceled, and Puerto Rico needs a process of decolonization, needless to say. We have to solve the what we call in Puerto Rico the status question, the colonial question. Puerto Rico is a colony. Just about everybody in Puerto Rico recognizes that. Anybody who looks at the Puerto Rican situation objectively recognizes that Puerto Rico is a colony. And colony, you know, colonialism is like slavery. It's something that, you know, has to disappear. It once you recognize it exists, then the next step you have to take is to abolish it. And so we need a decolonization process. So, you know, to summarize, we have to demand that they cancel the debt. We have to demand funds from Congress as a sort of compensation for the disasters caused by colonialism so that we can reconstruct our economy. And we need a decolonization process, a process for self-determination for Puerto Rico.
Well, it sounds like some of us in New York have to take a trip down to the federal bankruptcy court to assist our sisters and brothers from Puerto Rico, among the other things that Professor Rafael Bernabe has suggested. Thank you for the work that you do, for being with us. And we have been speaking with Professor Rafael Bernabe, professor and researcher at the University of Puerto Rico and an activist with the Working People's Party in Puerto Rico. And if you haven't read the book, you got to pick it up. You got to pick it up. And that is Puerto Rico in the American Century, a history since 1898 by Professor Rafael Bernabe with Cesar Ayala. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Rican and acclaimed poet Martin Espada.
such an honor to be here with all of you, because all of you freed Oscar Lopez Rivera. Some of you may have heard that Coca-Cola pulled its sponsorship of the Puerto Rican Day Parade, because Coca-Cola is a paragon of virtue in Latin America. Read up sometime on the killing of union organizers at Coke bottling plants in Colombia. And speaking of the tropics, I am from the tropical paradise of Brooklyn, New York. This poem is based on my first visit to Puerto Rico at the age of 11, where I saw for the first time the inner workings of the colonized mind as expressed in my family's choice of beverage. This is called Coca-Cola and Coco Frio. On his first visit to Puerto Rico, island of family folklore, the fat boy wandered from table to table with his mouth open. At every table, some great aunt would steer him with cool, spotted hands to a glass of Coca-Cola. One even sang to him in all the English he could remember a Coca-Cola jingle from the 40s. He drank obediently, though he was bored with this potion familiar from soda fountains in Brooklyn. Then, at a roadside stand off the beach, the fat boy opened his mouth to Coco Frio, a coconut chilled and scalped by a machete so that a straw could inhale the clear milk. The boy tilted the green shell overhead and drew coconut milk down his chin. Suddenly, Puerto Rico was not Coca-Cola or Brooklyn, and neither was he. For years afterward, the boy marveled at an island where the people drank Coca-Cola and sang jingles from World War II in a language they did not speak, while so many coconuts in the trees sagged, heavy with milk, swollen and unsuckled. Muchas gracias. Y viva Puerto Rico libre!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
coming up next.
This Way Out.
We went on a few dates, although I don't think we really liked each other that much as anything other than friends, which made them kind of fun but a little bit awkward of dates. We were also getting a little bit of pressure from friends who believed that because we were two girls who also liked girls, you know, we have to be able to click. We have to be able to be in a relationship together.
Whenever I meet a new gay person, there is kind of this implicit pressure to try to make it work because the dating pool is so much smaller.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Costa Rica's top court orders slow-motion marriage equality, activists survive violent attacks in Armenia and Lithuania, and queer teens deal with dating dilemmas. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 11th, 2018. Costa Rica's Supreme Court of Justice ruled in favor of marriage equality this week, but it was a two-edged sword. The justices gave lawmakers 18 months after their decision is officially published to pass enabling legislation. Queer advocacy groups are not happy about having to wait until sometime in 2020 to be able to walk down the aisle. Recently installed President Carlos Alvarado supported equality during an election campaign that was dominated at one time by an anti-queer evangelical preacher and singer. Alvarado announced that he'd be calling the Legislative Assembly into special session to expedite the advent of marriage equality. However, a minority caucus of evangelical Christian lawmakers has already signaled that it will do everything it can to block or at least stall the process. Costa Rica's Supreme Court of Justice really had no choice but to rule for marriage equality. A decision by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in January ordered all 20 nations that are signatories to the American Convention on Human Rights to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Four had already done so: Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, and Uruguay. In addition to Costa Rica, the remaining countries currently without marriage equality are Barbados, Bolivia, Chile, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, and Suriname, though queer couples can legally wed in Mexico City and 12 of Mexico's 31 states. Meanwhile, Costa Rican queer activists say they'll file a complaint with the Inter-American Court contesting the Supreme Court of Justice's 18-month delay in implementing its ruling.
LGBTQ activists came under attack this week in Armenia and Lithuania. In what Armenian queers are calling the worst homophobic attack in memory, nine activists who gathered at the home of one of them were surrounded by a group of some 30 men and a few women and children, all shouting anti-queer slurs and threatening to break in. Rainbow Armenia Initiative founder Haik Oprah Hakopian, who hosted the gathering, said he called the police, but the group decided to try to escape. In the beginning, they were just shouting that homosexuals can't live in this village, but it became violent very fast. We started running for our lives, Hakopian said. They followed us and started to beat us up and throw rocks. We all got hurt, but two of my friends are seriously injured and had to go to the hospital immediately. We ran up to the highway where they couldn't follow us anymore. He said that even though the nearest police station is less than 30 minutes from his home, police didn't show up until more than an hour after they were first called. Hakopian told Pink News that he can't go back home. I'll get killed if I go back, he said. He believes the attack was orchestrated by the village's former mayor, against whom Hakopian's family had filed corruption charges. It's common practice in Armenia to use people's sexual orientation to cover other political motives, he said.
The offices of the Lithuanian Gay League, the Baltic nation's only non-governmental organization advocating for LGBTQ people, were hit by arson in the early morning hours of August 10th. A passing taxi driver who noticed the front door and door blinds of the offices ablaze stopped to put it out with a portable fire extinguisher, preventing substantially more damage. Happily, no one was inside the building at the time. The league's executive director, Vladimir Simonko, said that it is disappointing to see such horrific crimes still take place in 2018 in the heart of our beautiful capital, Vilnius. The group also expressed concern that the arson attack would not be treated as the obvious hate crime that it was. Their office windows are adorned with rainbow flags, because authorities typically dismiss anti-queer attacks as simple hooliganism. A photo of the group's Facebook page showing some of the members holding small rainbow flags standing outside the charred office door was captioned, "Standing Proud and Strong." A report late last year by Amnesty International lays at least some of the blame for anti-queer sentiment in several post-Soviet countries like Armenia and Lithuania on Russia's aggressive laws against LGBTQ people, especially its so-called no-promo-homo law that bans dissemination of gay propaganda to minors.
16-year-old Maxim Neverov, who lives in the Russian town of Bisk, may have become the first teenager to be convicted of violating that law this week. According to the Russian LGBT network, the activist group that provided a lawyer for him, Neverov was arrested for posting on a Russian social network some pictures of young men whose appearance, partly nude body parts, had the characteristics of propaganda of homosexual relations. The group said the teen may have been targeted because, even at his young age, he's a high-profile activist who's attempted to organize a local pride parade and was spotted at a highly publicized protest in May called Gays or Putin. His lawyer is appealing the conviction and fine of 50,000 rubles, about $750 US, and says the authorities failed to prove that Neverov was even responsible for the posts after he refused to testify. Vladimir Putin happily signed the No Promo Homo Law in 2013. It criminalizes the exposure to minors of propaganda of non-traditional sexual relationships.
More than two dozen Russian LGBTQ activists were arrested on August 4th for staging an unsanctioned rally for freedom of association at Palace Square in St. Petersburg. One photo of the action shows a man holding a sign adorned with a rainbow and reading, "My mom loves me, my dad loves me, my friends love me, why can't you?" Each activist was dragged to a police bus after unfurling a rainbow flag or displaying a pro-queer sign, though there was no violence and no one was hurt. The action, in defiance of local authorities' refusal to issue a permit for it, was described as an effort to join similar demonstrations of pride being held around the world at this time of year. Technically, it's not illegal to be LGBTQ in Russia, but that no-promo-homo law has allowed anti-queer sentiment to flourish. A recent poll found that across all age ranges, 83% of the Russian public thinks that gay sex is always reprehensible or almost always reprehensible. The global queer advocacy group Outright International issued a report this week naming Russia as one of 85 countries in the world out of 194 where LGBTQ people are banned from public organizing. When states suppress LGBTIQ organizations, it concluded, they are really trying to stop LGBTIQ people from gaining basic human rights and equality.
An estimated 50,000 people took part in the annual Pride Parade in Belfast on the same day, August 4th. As we often report these days, it was the largest Pride crowd ever. The political message this year focused on continuing calls for British Prime Minister Theresa May and her government to open civil marriage to same-gender couples in the face of the paralyzed government in Northern Ireland. Amnesty International's Northern Ireland director Patrick Corrigan told reporters that the Belfast march is still very much a protest. "People on the streets of Belfast today," he said, "are sick of a second-class citizenship based on who they are and where they live." The parade capped off a 10-day Pride festival that involved more than 100 events, making it one of the city's biggest annual celebrations. A group of about 50 diehard religious fundamentalists gathered at Belfast City Hall to protest the event, reading Bible verses and singing hymns.
And finally, the organizers of Copenhagen Pride and the nation's largest advocacy group, LGBT Denmark, have each publicly rejected their invitation to a Pride reception at the residence of the U.S. ambassador on August 15th. The event was, until this year, considered to be one of the highlights of Pride Week during the tenure of Rufus Gifford, who served as U.S. ambassador to Denmark during the Obama administration. The openly gay Gifford, one of a number of out Obama appointees, was highly visible and quite popular, and even hosted his own television show, I Am the Ambassador, that prominently featured his husband Stephen. The couple married in Denmark in 2015. President Donald Trump replaced Gifford with Carla Sands, who had run a private equity firm. There was no reception in June 2017 because Trump had yet to fill the position. And the ambassadors from Australia, Canada, and the UK are co-hosting the new U.S. ambassador's first Pride reception this year. Copenhagen Pride had been the co-host in years past. While some activists have said they'll be attending, statements from both Copenhagen Pride and LGBT Denmark explained why they were giving this year's Pride shindig a frosty reception. While the statement by LGBT Denmark expressed a similar rationale, the comments of Thomas Rasmussen of Copenhagen Pride were perhaps the less diplomatic of the two. He told the queer Danish publication Out and About that it would sound pretty hollow if on the one side you criticized the Trump administration for their reluctance to accommodate LGBT people and the rolling back of LGBT-inclusive legislation, and at the same time stand around drinking champagne with the ambassador who represents that administration.
It's a little bit sad.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending August 11th, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the new and improved thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Have you checked our website lately?
For a review of recent programming and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show,
log on to thiswayout.org.
We live in the Northeast where it's very liberal, and we do have that opportunity to meet a lot of queer people because there is a greater number of people who come out. But if we're in somewhere like the South or in a country where it is illegal, right? I mean, imagine how hard that is.
Yes, imagine what it's like in repressive countries, or even in repressive centuries. Outcasting teens talk about today's romantic troubles, but first, a Rainbow Minute tells of a time when true love could really be out of tune.
Songwriter Lorenz Hart, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Lorenz Hart is best known as the lyricist half of the famed Broadway songwriting duo Rodgers and Hart. Born in Harlem, New York in 1895, Hart attended Columbia University. It was there he met and joined forces with Richard Rodgers, writing songs for student productions. Their musical collaboration would last until Hart's early death in 1943, producing songs like Blue Moon and My Funny Valentine.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile.
The team left a legacy of over 550 songs, including 8 movies and 8 Broadway musicals. Hart's lyrics were as witty as any sung on the Broadway stage, but he is remembered most for his songs about unfulfilled desire and failed romance. These themes he knew well. So tormented by his homosexuality back then, a fulfilling love life was an impossibility. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Jennifer Noel Catton.
Young love, our love, we share with deep emotion.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all of our sexually diverse communities.
Well, she walked up to me and she asked me if I wanted to dance. She looked kind of nice, so I said that I might take a chance. And when she danced, she held me tight. And when she left me home that night, stars were shining bright and then she kissed me.
Dating. Be honest. Is it ever easy? queer, straight, or figuring it out, whether you're 15 or 50, no matter what you may have heard, there is no standard textbook for dating. For LGBTQ teens, the challenges can be even more daunting than they are for alleged adults. The threat of outing can arise, even the potential for violence. What is it like to be queer in high school, trying to navigate all the usual difficulties of dating and handling so much more? Outcasting Overtime's Alex, Andrea, and Lauren share some of their experiences.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Alex, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, we talk about dating in high school. For most teenagers and high schoolers, dating is pretty challenging. But for queer teens, it can be even more challenging, and often we face challenges that straight people might not even imagine. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Alex.
I'm Andrea.
I'm Lauren.
All right. So to start, Andrea, I know you have a pretty interesting story about dating as a queer teenager.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really dating exactly. But there was this girl that I did not even know, had never met her before. I don't even know how she knew who I was. But she just sort of randomly started messaging me. And I knew her name because she goes to my school, and I just got this Facebook message that said, hey. So I responded, hi. And she was like, I realize you're new to the school, and you probably don't know who I am. So I was kind of confused by that because I'm not new to the school. But I just kind of assumed that it was an honest mistake. So I was like, you know, I'm not. Maybe you're mixing me with someone else, whatever. So when I established that I wasn't, she just sort of kind of kept the conversation going. And I thought, you know, I thought at first she was just kind of trying to be friendly or whatever, you know, that she was trying to make the best of an awkward situation. But it kind of kept going for a while. Eventually, I stopped answering. And I started sort of getting more texts from her, which I also wasn't answering at that point because I was starting to get kind of creeped out. And eventually she was like, do you have a Snapchat? Which I found a little bit creepy as well, seeing as I didn't know her.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
Yeah, it was a little strange. So I wasn't answering. But then finally, maybe like a week after that last text, I found out from one of my friends that the reason that she was doing this was to find out if I was gay. So I thought at this point that it was just, you know, like for gossip reasons, that she had just been like, you know, gossiping with her friends or something, and, you know, had come up that maybe I was gay and she wanted to find it out. So at this point, I was mostly just amused. You know, I saw this as being kind of dumb and ridiculous, but honestly pretty funny. So when I got a message from her again, I answered, and she said, she's like, I have a question for you. So I was like, okay, you know, wonder what that is. And she said that she had a friend who was really interested in me, and she, you know, that pronoun explicitly placed, wanted to know if I was interested. So, you know, I thought that was just her weird way of asking if I was gay, you know, because people can be weird about that sometimes, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just like very uncomfortable
very
asking about that
sometimes.
Kind of thing. Yeah, so I thought she was just, you know, like, you know, some straight person being weird about it.
But then the plot thickens.
Yes, the plot thickens. So, I kind of wanted to mess with her because, you know, I was like, this whole thing is just dumb. So I was like, I don't know. It depends who it is, you know, because I figured it was probably.
But also, yeah. That's a reasonable question.
Yeah.
If, yeah.
Yeah. But so, you know, it kind of went on for a bit. And, you know, eventually she was like, well, would you be interested in dating a girl? And I said, I'm gay. So she asked if I was in a relationship. So I'm like, okay, now this is clearly something actually happening, not just her like wondering if I'm gay for gossip reasons. So eventually she says, oh, it's me. You know, I'd been like really shy to talk to you for a long time. And like, I was kind of confused by that because, you know, I'd never even met her, like barely ever even seen her before. So it was kind of strange. You know, and I just said, like, sorry, I'm not interested. But she just sort of kept texting me, you know, she was like, can we just be friends? Which again, you know, in another situation, I would have been like, that's fine. But I wasn't really sure how that was going to happen when I didn't even know her. The whole thing was just strange. And she just kind of, you know, maybe like every week or so, she just texts me, hey, again, or something like that. And I haven't been answering, but she just keeps messaging me. And basically, I found out through some of my other friends that she is bi. But also, you know, we do all know that she does hook up with a lot of guys very regularly, and rumor is she's just sort of never been rejected. So it seems like that's sort of an interesting situation, too.
And also, I know all the parties involved. You two are very different in terms of personality. Yeah. So, I mean, I see that often a lot of queer people are forced into these awkward situations because,
I mean, maybe she hasn't come out to someone who isn't her close friend before. Yeah. Maybe this is her first time dating someone who is of the same gender as her.
Yeah,
and that can be a little scary for all of us, I think.
Yeah, and the whole thing was kind of weird, you know, because for me, like, I was put in a really weird, you know, because the whole way that she went about it was so strange. But on the other hand, there's also aspects of it where I see, like, okay, you know, like, if you're not comfortable coming out to someone, you're going to open it up in a weird way. Like, I have a friend. And it's like, to me, especially as someone who's been very open for a while about my sexuality, you know, it just seems very weird and like, you know, how old are we that you're like asking, oh, I have a friend. But like, I can see how if you're not that out and you're not comfortable with it, that might feel easier.
I feel like we can all kind of empathize with that. That kind of sense of, because it is kind of a whole new world coming out, and navigating it is kind of difficult for everyone.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of the time I'll hear straight people joking about like middle school relationships, and the things that they joke about sound awfully familiar to my experience of like high school relationships. Like, it's an awkward stage. Yeah.
Because no one is navigating queer relationships when they're 8 or 9.
Yeah,
this
is kind of 12.
Everyone is entering into new waters. And that means that all those awkward scenarios that many straight people had when they were very little, we kind of still have now.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I've had some pretty awkward scenarios just in terms of people communicating poorly or trying to communicate behind people's backs. I feel like you have an interesting story about this.
I have a similar story, and I now realize, sitting here thinking about it, that I've kind of been on both sides of it.
Oh, yeah.
When I was younger, I had a friend who she was the only queer girl in my school that I knew of. So I thought, okay, I have to have a crush on her then. But we did end up becoming...
no choice.
Yeah, no choice. But
she's the one. The only one.
But we did end up having... We're like really close friends now, so that it didn't really turn into anything, but it did turn into a good friendship. But then,
well, that's good.
Yeah,
I mean, because often, like, if you interact with another queer person you might be attracted to, it's also the scenario that that might be the only other queer person, and you already have a lot in common.
Yeah,
but also you could learn a lot from that person, even if you don't have a romantic relationship. I mean, sometimes there are more important things than getting in bed with someone.
That's. Getting intense and outcasting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's true.
Maybe the person who talked to you, Andrea, will learn something from this.
Yeah, probably.
Hopefully. Because that was dreadfully awkward.
So far, I've heard that she probably will not give up very quickly, and it seems so far that she's not really giving up. But, you know, I think she'll probably learn something from this.
She's persistent.
Yes.
That's right.
The other side of it that I've been on is kind of more similar to Andrea's story, which is that there was a girl who had kind of just come out, or at least she just started to understand that she was bisexual or gay. I'm not really sure how she identifies personally, but she saw me as an openly queer person in my school, which there are not a lot of, really. And we went on a few dates, although we didn't really know each other that well. And I don't think we really liked each other that much as anything other than friends, which made them very kind of fun, but a little bit awkward of dates. We were also getting a little bit of pressure from friends who believed that because we were two girls who also liked girls, we must, you know, we have to be able to click. We have to be able to be in a relationship together, but that's not always the case.
I mean, whenever I meet a new gay person, there is kind of this implicit pressure to try to make it work because there are so many, the dating pool is so much smaller. But of course, I mean, some people on the outset, it might seem like they're perfect for each other, but starting to date and getting along is challenging, right? There are things appear when you start spending intimate time with someone that, I mean, those are not just unique to straight people or queer people. There's something that we all face, but for us, our dating pool is so much smaller. It's a greater challenge to find people in the first place. And then, of course, there's that added addition where maybe I won't get along. Maybe we're not compatible. Maybe there's some other thing that might not. Maybe we have political differences. Maybe we have ideological differences, ethical differences. There's things like that are something that I think straight couples and gay couples, all sorts of couples face. But because our dating pool is so much smaller, that kind of exacerbates it in our minds. Do you feel that?
A little bit. I think so. And I mean, luckily this is not something I've had any personal experience with, but I've heard that rates of partner violence, abuse, are higher in LGBT relationships, partially because of this kind of scenario. You think, okay, well, this person likes me. There might not be another
a feeling of being trapped in the relationship.
Yeah.
Because the only one, right? There is only so many tries, which I think is not true, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
In this day and age, I think the dating pool is somewhat lenient because so many more people are coming out. Yeah. But there is kind of a pressure to kind of stick with someone once you find them.
Yeah.
And we live in the Northeast where it's very liberal, and we do have that opportunity to meet a lot of queer people because there is mm-hmm. a greater number of people who come out. But if you're in somewhere like the South or in a country where it is illegal, right? I mean, imagine how hard that is. In the past also, of course, I mean.
Yeah, because it's weird, even when you're out, it's not even necessarily that this other specific person will know you're out. So for example, with the story that I was just telling, this girl was basically harassing one of my friends, trying to figure out what my sexuality was. And my friend felt okay, even though I'm very out, my friend felt okay, this is not my information to share.
Yes.
To the point
she was very our friend was very respectful about
yeah
it.
And to the point where this girl was harassing my friend so much that she actually told this girl that we had a huge fight and she didn't know. Which is a lie, because she was just so sick of this girl not giving up, even when she said, this is not my information to share. And rumor, this friend had also told me that this same girl had been asking about one of my other friends who's bisexual, and, also she hadn't been saying anything.
That's all the time we have for now. We'll continue the conversation next time.
I haven't had any guys ask me out, but I have definitely had situations where there's been guys who I'm pretty sure they're flirting with me, and it's a really uncomfortable scenario.
I certainly am not comfortable flirting or talking to someone who I really don't know is gay, right? It's challenging in all sorts of ways.
I look feminine and I assume that people will think that I'm straight, and I don't want that.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producer is Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofus. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Brian DeShazer and Michelle Yeader, from Jennifer Catton, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Outcasters Alex Lauren and Andrea, produced by Mark Sophos. Sam Smith and St. Vincent performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the redesigned thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, WDRT Viroqua, Wisconsin, Gay SA Radio Pretoria, South Africa, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. From community policing to body cameras to implicit bias training, there's no end of reform ideas for reining in the brutality of the police. But what if that brutality were central to the institution itself, not something that could be reformed away? In Police, a Field Guide, published by Verso, David Correa and his co-author Tyler Wall look at the language of police and police reform from weaponry to police values. They argue that policing is not about public safety, but about imposing social order under capitalism. Correa is associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and joins me now from Albuquerque. David, what is cop speak and why should we be wary of it?
In my view, cop speak is what makes it impossible to have any kind of conversation about police that isn't one patrolled by police. Because, you know, most of the words we use to talk about police, threat, emergency, discretion, you know, tear gas, taser, order, security, you name it, are all words that come to us defined already by police. And this is a language, even if you know, some of us have other definitions, this mainstream or establishment definition is a kind of language that Tyler and I call cop speak, which means that ultimately we're always talking about police the way police want us to talk about police. Which is, you know, is a world imagined as full of threats and emergencies and one that requires some sort of specialized and armed branch of the state to patrol, to guarantee safety and security. And that armed branch of the state is police. And there can be no democracy and there can be no order without police. And so this whole language, you know, is we refer to as cop speak, as a way to sort of name it. This is an actual language. It has its own vernacular and has very specific kinds of definitions of terms and concepts. And if we don't get underneath those and really try to understand what it is police mean when they talk of threats and emergencies and what we ought to mean instead when we talk about it, it's really easy to fall into what I think is a trap. And it's the trap is police reform. I mean, that's the trap. And there can be no police reform as we know it without cop speak. With cop speak, police reform is an entire politics of that ends with more police and more weapons and but you know, just promising that those cops will be nicer and they'll be better trained and they won't be shooting young black men in the back, or they won't be assaulting and killing young homeless Native women in the streets. That's just an aberration. And when we refuse cop speak, then we can see police for what it really is, which is the racialized socio-spatial control of the poor. And that's what we're trying to do in the book, is offer an antidote to cop speak, so that activists or anyone who really cares about confronting the very real ongoing and historical problem of police violence without having to, you know, to rely on the language police give us to do that.
And we'll talk more as we go on about police reform and the perils of police reform as you see it. Why is policing the poor so central to capitalism and therefore so central to the police?
Our book is mostly about North America for the most part, the U.S. specifically. But we try to think a little bit transnationally in the book. And so if you're thinking about police and the origins of police, particularly in the European context, it entirely emerges out of the transition from feudalism to capitalism and this desperate need to organize the suddenly mobile poor, right, released from the bondage of feudalism. And that sort of version of liberty that comes with the transition to capitalism also comes with it, you know, great sort of like logistical and organizational problems for capitalism. Like we have those vagrants, as they were called, you know, have to be made available for wage labor, and it's police, you know, as the logic that organizes this. And so, you know, in the European context, police emerge out of this need to organize the poor, to be made available as this sort of reserve army, as Marx would call them, and become wage laborers, like disciplined into wage laborers. That's true also in the U.S., where the police are, you know, are really preoccupied with, you know, property and defending property rights and enforcing property rights. There really can't be a capitalism without police, because the property relations at the heart of capitalism have to be enforced. There is no property without enforcement, and enforcement requires violence, and there has to be a legitimate violence that the state can rely on to enforce those particular social relations and conditions that make capitalism possible. So there has to be a police. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a public police, right? I mean, historically in the U.S., police have often been and still are largely private, paid for privately to serve private economic interests, to reinforce those property relations, so that there actually can be the property relations necessary for capitalism. That's what police are and always will be and always have been. In the U.S. context, though, it also comes out of the slave patrols and the settler colonial militias that, of course, can't be separated from questions of property, but also, I think, are very much about, you know, police are defending an order of property, but also patrolling a racial line in the U.S.
Yeah, tell us more about how the police, who are ubiquitous in all sorts of societies around the world, what kind of policing do we tend to see in settler colonial states, and why?
Well, you know, I think there is something unique about the policing in settler colonial states like the U.S. or Canada or Australia, New Zealand or Israel, and it has everything to do with a particular kind of of spatial control of the indigenous body. I live in Albuquerque, and Albuquerque is a border town, borders on Pueblos and Navajo Nation, and it's not an accident that indigenous people, when they come into contact with police, are often told, go back to the reservation. I mean, I've done interviews with native homeless people in Albuquerque who tell me, like, that's what we hear when we come into contact with cops. And Shireen Razick's written a brilliant book called Dying from Improvement about, colonial policing in Canada, identifies a sort of the same process whereby the present sort of indigenous presence is actually a kind of accusation, that the settler colonial project is ongoing and unfinished, and it is the police that have to make that indigenous body invisible, right? They have to always be invisible. Their mere presence is a crime. And, I've been to, hearings by the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission where, one Native person after another comes up to give testimony. And, it's like literally walking down the street becomes fraught with all kinds of problems for Native people in the city because they're constantly being pulled over. They're constantly being harassed by cops. And it's because in settler colonial states, the whole project, the whole settler colonial project, is the elimination of the native and the claimed native land, and that's a police project. That's always been a police project, and it's an ongoing police project. And I think it's more obvious when you're in a border town like Albuquerque or Gallup, New Mexico, or Rapid City, South Dakota, or Saskatoon, Canada, but it's true everywhere else as well in settler states. And so the slave patrol and the militia are the first cops in the U.S. And all the terms that we use to describe and talk about police were come to us from the slave patrol or the colonial militia. The patrol, right, is a word that sort of the origins of the word were come to us from the slave patrol. They were very specific and referred to the policing and control of slaves, enslaved Africans and native people. And it might not be true to draw a direct line from the slave patrol or the colonial militia to contemporary police. But that's the model. That's the model that all contemporary policing emerges from.
In your book, one of the dimensions of policing that you explore is that of the values of policing and the police. And I wanted to ask you about the key value of order and its flip side, disorder. What do those mean, and why are they so important in understanding policing?
Well, order might be the most important concept to understand police. It's not usually the concept that we turn to. It's one of the reasons why police are so difficult to talk about and understand, because the fallback way we usually think about police or are told to think about police is as crime fighters and as law enforcement. But, police, there's very little that police do that's actually related to crime. It's all about order, the imposition or the fabrication of order itself, and the idea that cops inhabit or patrol the thin blue line between order or disorder, civilization, savagery. These are binaries that police, defend. Police are very, very explicit about this. I mean, if anyone has any familiarity with police, you're probably familiar with William Bratton, who is the police chief in L.A. and mm-hmm. Boston and New York, and his theory of broken windows policing, which he took from some sociologists, who sort of elaborated this theory of broken windows. And it's very explicitly about, cops are not about crime prevention or enforcement or law enforcement. Police impose order, And theirs was a very normative order about, like, the property owners or the heterosexual, you know, male and female couple with children, and the city's for them. And the job of the cop is to really patrol that city and make sure that the vagrants are kept in their place and the city is made safe for, you know, for people who belong there. And, I mean, it's throughout the book, you know, we draw quite a bit on this because we're trying to point out that this is not some sort of, like, hidden agenda. This is out in the open among police and police reformers. And, you know, it's very, and so when we're talking about police, we better start by saying, well, what is the order then that police impose? And it's an absolutely racialized order, and it's a propertied order. And there's really, therefore, nothing that a cop can do or police can do that any court would later find fault with, as long as it's in service to that order, that normative order of property, defending a racial line, serving normative values that police define on the street. You know, they're the administrative authority on the street at any given time, and cops have wide discretion, really unlimited discretion, to decide what to do, how to confront a problem that they identify as a problem. No court's going to come in after the fact and say, that cop maybe shouldn't have had that discretion to make the decision that he or she made. They might, and very occasionally do, say that some decision a cop made was not the right decision, but that doesn't change the fact that the person maybe they killed is still dead, that the injury they caused can't be undone. So, you know, in the book, we call that unlimited. Like, the cops have unlimited discretion to make decisions on, you know, what is an emergency, who is a threat, and how do I, as a police officer, respond to that threat. And that's all about order. That's not about crime fighting or law enforcement. That's just about order. You see that. I mean, I think that the video that we recently saw about Alton Sterling, right, and the way the cop was very sort of clearly talking about a kind of an expectation of behavior. You don't belong here, and you're not behaving the way I want you to behave, and there are consequences for that. The way that the cop dealt with Sandra Bland, right, that you know, you're not behaving appropriately, you don't belong here. These are not aberrations. These are not bad apple cops. This is how policing is done, because it's about imposing a normative and racialized order. And so we have to start, at least we think that we have to start with the concept of order to really get at what it is police do, what kind of institution it is in society, and how it works.
I'm speaking with David Correa about his co-authored book, Police, A Field Guide. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in terms of thinking about the order that the police impose, is the notion of order as defined by the police one holy that comes on high, or is there also some notion of the specter of disorder that this order is supposed to keep a lid on?
Well, yeah, that's one of the sort of hallmarks of cop speak, is this idea that there is always disorder lurking around every corner. You know, that, I mean, really every if you break apart every concept that cops rely on, whether it's jurisdiction or discretion or threat or emergency, you know, buried within all of those is this idea that that there is great disorder without police. And it's a very specific kind of police, right? I mean, the version that we have is this absolutely necessary version. We're taught that there literally is no democracy without police. Without police, we don't live in a free society. So liberal democracy requires police. And so therefore there's no alternative, right? So in these shocking examples of police violence, such as on March 18th in Sacramento with the killing of Stephon Clark, our reaction of anger really can only just resolve into acceptance. Well, what can we do? I guess it's not like we can abolish police, so we just have to have better training, and maybe we have to figure out a way to make sure that these things don't happen in the future, and, And there's all kinds of, you know, reformists are always ready to offer the same and similar kinds of suggestions to do that. And it's always premised on the idea that, well, you know, we're going to make some mistakes, and we're sorry to the family of Stephon Clark. But, you know, I mean, we have to engage in this form and kind and mode of policing, or else we're going to have incredible disorder. There's no alternative. And so really, I wouldn't say that this is something that that police hold dear and the rest of us look on with skepticism. I think it's widely held belief, whether we're talking about really anywhere on the political spectrum, conservatives and liberals alike share this idea that, you know, police are absolutely necessary. And so if police are necessary, then we're sort of left with this idea of relying on police reform and these sort of familiar things about, like, calling the cops that do these bad things bad apples and considering this all an aberration. And really exonerating the institution itself and focusing our attention on individual cops, because it's the institution that guarantees our safety and security, and it's a few bad apples that make it difficult for us to understand how cops can be better, and that is all designed. I mean, we try to really focus on that in the book to demonstrate the way in which that doesn't just exonerate the institution itself from responsibility for the actions of individual cops, but it exonerates the institution from any scrutiny. Right? I mean, it's just, there's nothing we can do. We need police because without it, it'll be barbarism and savagery and anti-civilization. And therefore, we have to hold fast to this commitment we have to police. Really, everything cops do and everything police reform does is about restoring this faith in police, because without it, right, without that faith in police, that institution then suddenly is open to question, and we can start asking after possible alternatives, and is there some other way that maybe our safety and security could be ensured?
What's interesting, though, is that although one can see particular populations being particularly prone to the notion that the police are protecting them from savagery, that's the very racialized ideas that many whites hold on to.
Yeah.
It's striking, though, that although many people of color fear the police, there are also polls that show that substantial numbers of people of color also support the police as an institution.
Yeah, and partly it's because of this idea of no alternative. Right? There's no alternative. And it's also true that, I mean, every time I talk to people about police, there's always someone, and rightfully so, who's going to say, well, yeah, but, I mean, I'm a victim of crime, or someone in my family was a victim of crime, and who else can I turn to other than police to guarantee my or their safety? And sure, it's not perfect, and of course it could be better, but there was no alternative. And it's this idea of no alternative that is important to really get at, that there are alternatives, but there are other ways to organize our sort of collective safety and security. And when we really look empirically at police, it's pretty easy to point out that only some people are safe and secure because of police. You know, when I was involved in anti-police violence organizing in Albuquerque after the police killing of James Boyd and 2014, you know, I really remember vividly this. I was at a meeting, and this prominent white member of the community stood up, and he said, you know, I'm really scared now when I drive home from work in my Prius to the Heights, this sort of like upper class part of town, because I'm fearful police will pull me over and kill me. And, you know, at the time, at that moment, that wasn't absurd and laughable. There was this sort of potent fear, I think, generally about the way the Albuquerque Police Department operated. And that, you know, that fear resolved itself fairly quickly among, you know, white, wealthy residents of Albuquerque who came to realize after a while, well, yeah, actually, you know, I'm safe, and, you know, my community is fairly safe and secure. And that didn't change for the sort of working class communities, you know, populated largely by people of color, who remain fearful of police. Right? So it's you know, it, but I still, you know, am not surprised when people point out to me, well, what else can we do? You know, I mean, it's like there's no alternative. And that's not to mention, that's not even to mention the fact that most people have cops in their family, right? And so it's like, well, they're, you know, my brother's a cop and he's nice, and or my uncle's a cop and he seems like a nice person. And so maybe you're over exaggerating and maybe you're not fairly depicting police. And that's, you know, I think that's a function of constantly, you know, when we talk about police, thinking of some person in uniform rather than thinking of an institution and forgetting that, you know, people don't change institutions. Institutions change people often, and therefore you can go into, you know, the police. You can want to help and become a cop, and then be shocked by what you find yourself doing, because it's about imposing an order that requires the use of great violence often, or the threat of violence. That's what cops do, and that we have to remember that when we want to talk about building an alternative to police.
Well, that tricky aspect of the police being part of the working class, one of the places that that conundrum comes up and that you and your co-author write about in Police, a Field Guide, is around police unions. Can you explain how you understand the role of police unions? Usually those of us on the left are ready to support unions, but police unions seem to play a distinctive role.
Yeah, first of all, police, you know, if we're going to talk about individual cops, we might say that they probably are, in sort of economic terms, working class, in a sort of like abstract way. But police unions demonstrate no solidarity with the working class in general, and certainly no solidarity with other unions. In fact, the origins of police unions come out of the anti-union busting activities of cops, you know, and the sort of the role that cops played in cracking down and on civil rights activists in the Jim Crow South and union busting tactics in the North, both private police in the 1800s and early 1900s, and then municipal police after that, and it became really obvious to police that, you know, forming unions served this dual feature. Number one, it, you know, serves their collective interest as workers. So in that sense, police unions are a kind, you know, they're collectives of workers who have a shared economic interest and express that shared interest through their union. But the formation of unions also serve to actually disguise what it is that police have historically done and continue to do, which is to actually work in opposition to the interests of other workers and the working class more generally. So we have to be really wary when we think about the police as members of the working class, because, you know, the police operate to defend the interests generally of those who are not, who don't have shared interests to the working class, and defend property rights and impose restrictions on worker rights. And those, you know, there's no way that that's consistent with what we would expect as the solidarity we need from unions generally in the working class. So, you know, but police unions, by the way, are very effective. I mean, they're among the most well-organized public sector unions in the U.S. They're very effective at like representing their members. And they also are mostly really good at reminding the communities in which they find themselves how important they are, and how absolutely essential police are. And so, you know, if you go to any city council meeting when they're talking about police salaries, I mean, they have the largest voices and are very influential. You know, in Albuquerque, I can't open the newspaper without there being an article quoting the police union representative talking about the need for higher salaries for police, and, you know, and being very effective at that. So they look like unions. They appear to represent their members in a way that are similar to other kinds of unions. But there's, you know, their interests are actually opposed to the interests of the working class more generally.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with David Correa. He's co-author with Tyler Wall of Police, a field guide that's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. David Correa is associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. So one of the things that your book does is enumerates the weapons, in broad terms, that the police deploy to impose the sort of social order and racial order that they do. And I wonder if you could tell us about the origin of the taser. That is one weapon that we associate with the police. How did that come about?
Yeah, the taser, it's not an accident that it's like a cattle prod, because the first electronic currency weapons similar to tasers were actual cattle prods. And the company, the most common taser in use by cops is by a company formerly called Taser International. And, you know, the guy that invented it, you know, was inspired by science fiction novels and was watching the Watts riots in 1965 and imagined some way in which, you know, police could have some weapon. It would be a kind of crowd control weapon. And, you know, it presented this as a kind of like reform weapon, a non-lethal thing. It wouldn't leave the, you know, up until that point, cops were using billy clubs and their weapon, their service revolvers, and, you know, leaving literally bloody battlefields behind them. And when they were engaged in union busting fights or against civil rights marchers. And so the taser was this solution to an intractable problem for police, which was like, how do we control unruly crowds? And, you know, so any gathering, any crowd to police is an unruly or potentially unruly crowd. And so the taser becomes this sort of like magical weapon that police can use to suddenly be more effective in these crowd control, in the moments they need crowd control, and not resort to lethal weapon. That was the promise. So this taser is really effective, and it promises to give police powers that, you know, prior to the use of taser, they wouldn't have had. And but it's hardly the non-lethal weapon that police promise it to be. I mean, there's been scores and scores of deaths in the U.S. alone in the last 15 years through the use of tasers. Like any weapon, like any claimed non-lethal weapon that police use, there are only very, very specific kinds of circumstances under which it is non-lethal. And so the taser is often used in ways that contribute to a lethality that they claim doesn't exist with it. And in fact, there's like the cops have special words to describe what happens to people when they die in encounters with cops who use tasers. And it's usually there's something wrong with the person. They, you know, excited delirium syndrome is this phrase that cops have used, which no doctor would admit to being a legitimate condition, but which cops and courts have said, well, the person died as a result of this taser injury, not because of the misuse of the taser, but because they suffer from something called excited delirium syndrome that leaves them susceptible to major injury as a result of the taser. And, you know, so in other words, If you're nervous, if you're anxious, if your heart rate is up, if you're acting erratically, those are the circumstances under which a taser might be fatal. As though no one already feels that way when they're when they encounter a cop who's about to use a taser on them.
Indeed.
And these are the ways that, like, so the taser is this. Is this completely lethal weapon that we are told is non-lethal and actually solves this sort of like serious problem of police lethality, and we should be happy with the use of the taser. But in reality, it's a weapon like any other weapon that is used and misused and leads to deaths, and we shouldn't be surprised about that. And we shouldn't and calls for reforms that rely on the taser are really only forms of reform that just serve the interest of expanding police powers more generally. Anyways, so now police just have multiple choices of weapons, all of which are designed to do great harm and use great pain in their application.
Well, another weapon which is classified as less than lethal is tear gas. Tear gas is meant to be not lethal, used under particular circumstances. What are those circumstances?
Yeah, tear gas, there are very specific circumstances under which tear gas is not lethal, and none of those circumstances describe the way cops use tear gas. I mean, you'd have to be in an open ventilated place and have access to water so you could clear eyes and clear it out of your system. Police weaponize tear gas, right? They fire it from canisters, so they're blunt trauma injuries to people who are hit by those canisters. You know, they often use them in closed spaces so that there's no escape from the sort of intense amount of tear gas that police use. Police are indiscriminate often in the use of tear gas, whether there's children, right, or pregnant women, of course, who are particularly susceptible for to injuries related to tear gas. And so it's not an accident that, well, police may call it an accident, but it's not an accident that there are, of course, fatalities and serious injuries related to tear gas. I mean, if you recall the Occupy protests at the University of California, Davis, or the 1999 WTO protests, where police were pulling off, protesters' face masks and spraying tear gas directly into their faces at close range, this is not how we're promised tear gas is used by police, because these are particularly the kinds of tactics that lead to permanent injuries or fatal injuries. And of course, tear gas, by the way, is banned as a weapon of war, but allowed to be used by police all over the world. And the logic of this is that, combatants in war wouldn't really be able to know whether tear gas is sort of basic CS gas or maybe poison gas, whereas protesters on the street can be assured that when police use tear gas, they're using the benign version that isn't poison gas, which is a real logical leap that relies on the premise that, police have our interests at heart, and police would not engage in tactics that actually expose us to risks in ways that they do. And so tear gas ends up being another one of these sort of reform tools, these weapons that promise some sort of less lethal outcome, but in practice, because of the way that police use it, it's no different than the taser or the service weapon or any other weapon that police use. It has no less lethal than anything else that police use.
Another weapon of the police, which is much less obvious as a weapon, is the Rough Ride, which Freddie Gray fatally received in Baltimore in 2015. Can you tell us what the Rough Ride is and why it is so dangerous?
Yeah, the Rough Ride, it's what they call it in Baltimore. They call it a nickel ride in Philly. Every cop everywhere uses some version of it. What happened to Freddie Gray was this sort of the version of it that people are probably familiar with because of Freddie Gray, where the cops will grab somebody and throw them into the back of a paddy wagon or a police van, and that person is probably, as Freddie Gray was, handcuffed with his hands behind his back, sometimes legs shackled together. And then not secured in the van. So, if you've ever been in the back of a police van, this is just a metal box with sharp edges on everything. And there are often seat restraints. But the point of the Rough Ride is to deliver what's called street justice, so the person is not secured in there. And then the officer drives erratically and at high speeds. They drove Freddie Gray around Baltimore for like an hour, erratically stopping, speeding and then stopping and driving at high speeds. And Freddie Gray had no way to protect himself in the back of the wagon, and so he was flying all over. And by the time they got to the Western District Station in Baltimore, his spine was severed, and he died later at the hospital. I've talked to people on the street in Albuquerque who've described similar things, where they're thrown into the back of a police cruiser, their hands cuffed behind them, and then the cop will drive erratically as they just are just ricocheting around the back. And it's intended as a way to deliver a beating without having to do it oneself. I mean, that's the point of the rough ride. And as we point out in the book, you know, the way that the media, particularly in the wake of Freddie Gray's death, depicted, it's a kind of like, you know, it's a kind of like unspoken tactic that cops we use, right? It's someone gives you lip, give them a rough ride. Someone's not polite, back in the wagon, let's give them a rough ride, or her a rough ride. And you know, the question we ask is, you know, what does it say about police that the camaraderie, the unspoken language that the cops speak to someone is a language that, requires great suffering by those people that they arrest or they capture. I think what that suggests is that, you know, the rough ride is not some sort of aberration. It doesn't describe some sort of, the actions of a few bad apples, but rather it really structurally explains how police are organized and what police see the job as. It's delivering a beating. It's delivering a punishment, because that's what cops can do, and that, you know, that person deserves it somehow. And cops are required to do it. Right? It becomes part of the job. I've talked to many former cops who've chosen not to be cops, who've described those moments when it's expected that they use their service weapon. It's expected that they engage in this kind of extra legal punishment. And if they don't, it's made clear to them that that's the job of police. And the fact that you don't do it is a risk to the rest of us who do engage in this practice. So, that, you know, the fact that it has a name and we think of it as relating to a specific place, I think disguises the fact that this is a practice widely. It's not unusual. Every cop has either done it or knows a cop who's done it, even if they don't even think it's wrong. This is as common as the traffic ticket.
David Corre is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about his book, Police, A Field Guide. One of the things that you write about in the book is sexual violence from the police. And you write that rape is the second most frequent complaint against the police. Tell us about rape as a weapon of sorts, as you see it, of police violence.
Yeah, I mean, this is a hard one for people to consider, because we have to first understand rape is part of a larger practice of terror that police use to, as we, you know, we keep people in their place. For example, I was on the street interviewing homeless people a few years ago, and particularly talking to Native trans women in Albuquerque who are on the street, and the idea that they might not have confronted sexual violence by police was like this laughable idea. And anyone who would talk to me on the street thought it silly that I was even asking the question, that it was such a common part of the violent encounter that particularly, at least in Albuquerque, Native trans women on the street experience when they come into contact with police. And of course, if you're living on the street, you're always coming into contact with police. And it, you know, it's one of those that, you know, it's never framed as a form of sexual terror. You know, it's often just this, you know, this aberration. It's so shocking, so unbelievable as to be impossible to picture as a sort of common or regular practice. I mean, I think particularly our writing about rape as a practice of sexual terror by police is one of the reasons why cops really hate this book. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why police don't like this book, but that one has really, I think, for them, has gone too far. But when you look at the numbers and you see, you know, researchers who are really interested in what kind of complaints are lodged against the police, like sexual violence is a common complaint lodged against the police. And by the way, I would say that all complaints lodged against police can only possibly constitute a small minority of all the sort of problems that we might identify by police. I mean, it's very difficult to complain, number one. You put yourself at great risk often when you're complaining publicly about police, because often the only person to complain to is the police institution of individual cops. So the fact that it's so common tells us something about the structural nature of this as a key tactic. And so, you know, particularly feminist scholars are quick to point out that, you know, it's you know, this is supposed to be the institution that someone would turn to who needs safety and security, and it ends up being the very institution that exploits that, which are police. And, you know, so in the entry on rape, and also, by the way, the entry on strip search, we have also an entry on strip search, which we point out is kind of like a version of a state-sanctioned rape. You know, you realize that this is a really common practice. I mean, the strip search itself is shocking.
This is the body cavity search, both men and women are subjected to.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, if we just describe the practice, it's a form of rape. And any legal definition of rape would include what police do or jailers do when they engage in a body cavity search, the unwanted, particularly for women, but not only for women, penetration of sexual organs. That's what police do, and it's common. And, you know, and there have been exposés every now and then, the most famous one in Chicago in the 70s, about the sort of common way in which the Chicago Police Department used body cavity searches and strip searches of women for even like basic traffic tickets, right? Just a traffic violation, and they would engage in this body cavity search, this forced, unwanted body cavity search. What is this if not state rape, we ask in the book. And but of course law sees it as essential to securing safety and security of society more generally, and gives to police the authority, in fact, wide authority. I mean, it's legal for a cop to engage in a body cavity search, a forced body cavity search of someone without a warrant. They couldn't look in your pockets. They couldn't look in your trunk of your car legally without reasonable suspicion, but they could engage in a body cavity search without that same level of legal standard. And so I think we have to understand sexual violence as a real organizing principle of police when we're talking about how they fabricate order.
Well, let's finish by talking about police reform. Listeners might hear what you've just been talking about body cavity searches, and think, well, that is clearly something that needs to be reformed, even if the police themselves as an institution are problematic. Shouldn't we attempt to rein in some of these most egregious aspects of policing while working toward, as you would argue, an alternative to the police as an institution?
Well, I think that's often how it starts. I mean, if you consider it, you know, take any city that has recently been in the news, whether it's New York or Sacramento or L.A. or Baltimore or Ferguson, Missouri. You know, this desire to confront this problem asks those kinds of questions, but it often then gives way to this official narrative, which is really all about restoring the legitimacy of police. Police reform really doesn't have anything to do with confronting the real problems that we've just been talking about today. It's all about restoring the legitimacy of the police more generally. And that language is clear. I mean, if you just read any police reform, any article about police reform in any newspaper, and there's going to be some police commissioner or police union official or elected official who's going to say something about, well, we really have to restore the public's trust in police. And that's what reform is really about. And the ways that happens are almost the same everywhere. I mean, there's this idea about, well, let's get rid of the bad apples, which means, you know, raise our hiring standards and improve our training. And then there's usually let's get rid of the bad leadership. So it's going to fire some cops and we're going to bring in some new leaders. And then it's going to be like, Well, you know, let's offer cops alternatives to lethal weapons. And so, you know, the expansion of things like the uses of taser and canine dogs, which also, and my co-author Tyler Wall writes about the use of dogs, these are supposed to be tools that, you know, that cops can draw on so that these encounters are not so often lethal. And, you know, maybe it could improve the way that cops use these weapons. Or, you know, often the language is, well, we need more community policing. And I would, you know, we're really, in this book, very suspicious of all language of community policing, because to us, and I think, you know, we make the argument that this is a form of counterinsurgency. Community policing is often about really at a fine grain level, forcing a kind of restored legitimacy of police by embedding police into the community, which is about just, you know, expanding the ability of police to surveil, to, you know, to expand the police powers more generally into our everyday lives. And I can't think of any police reform procedure that has ever led to what we might call this totally reformed police department that now doesn't engage in all these problems that we've seen before. It's you know, the history of police in this country, as my co-author Tyler Wall likes to say, is crisis, reform, crisis, right? It's like some crisis, some spectacular example of police violence, followed by uproar and anger, followed by police reform, followed, and then just repeat. The process happens all over again. And so, you know, when we think about police reform, then we're not thinking about confronting the problem of police violence more generally. And, you know, I mean, there's ways to, I mean, I'm neither Tyler nor myself are suggesting for 1 minute that we should do nothing. I mean, I think we should support all proposals that lead to the less, you know, cops using fewer weapons and having less access to weapons. Any proposals that reduce the size and scope of police powers more generally, we should support. Any proposals that actually shift the actual job of policing to non-police, we should support. And these are all ways to try to these are kind of alternatives, I think, that bring us in a direction that might not lead to what we usually get with standard establishment police reform, which is often more police, more weapons, more aggressive policing generally. That's, you know, in Albuquerque after 2014, when this city exploded after the police killing of James Boyd, the response, even with the presence of the Department of Justice in town forcing reforms, is now this drumbeat for we need more cops and they need to have more discretion. And those cops need to, of course, they'll have better training and everything will be fine in that regard. But without it, there's no safety and security. So all that anger gets resolved into more cops, more weapons, more policing. That's what reform does. That's establishment reform. And, you know, we write quite a bit in the book about the pitfalls of that. And we're trying to make sure that our readers understand what cops mean when they talk about police reform, because it's not about confronting. Police reform is about you and me, not cops. It's about getting you and me to submit to police and policing more generally and more willingly, because we might somehow be led to believe it's nicer and gentler and reformed, when in fact all it is about changing the sort of relationship the police have with us so that we are better police subjects.
And the book in question is Police, A Field Guide. It is co-authored by David Correa, my guest today, and Tyler Wall, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. David Correa teaches in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, and his other books include Properties of Violence. David, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.
Hey.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.